Select Committee on Finance, officials from Parliament, Treasury, SARS, our guests, stakeholders, you are welcome to this meeting. There are quite a number of apologies. I think many members will join us. They are attending other meetings. The chairperson of the Select Committee, Honorable Yunis Karim, has called that he will be joining us anytime from now. Be that as it may, let me declare the meeting officially open, and as I've already done, welcome everybody who is here. The purpose of this meeting is for submissions by stakeholders on the draft tax bills 2019 that have already been issued out by Treasury. We have, as a committees of Parliament, Select Committee on Finance and Standing Committee on Finance, received a briefing or got a briefing from Treasury and SARS in regard to the draft tax bills, and we have agreed that we should schedule for public hearings on this day, that is today, so that stakeholders air their views in regard to the tax bills 2019. Chairperson, Honorable Karim, you are welcome. When you just got in, I was officially opening the meeting and welcoming stakeholders and members of Parliament, realizing that we have got not much time today because of parliamentary sessions in the afternoon. So we don't want to do things at a very fast pace that stakeholders feel that they were not given enough opportunity. So you are welcome, Chairperson Honorable Karim. Any introductory remarks, Chairperson?
Just an announcement. Thanks, Coach. Firstly, an apology for being 3 minutes late. I'm sorry. Next thing, we are unfortunately from the Select Committee on Finance side, that's the NCOP committee, split into two groups, because simultaneously is the special appropriations bill of ESCOM and this. So the chairperson on the other side, Comrade Mashlangu, asked if we could split it up, and we agreed. So half of our committee is here, half day. Thank you very much.
Okay. No, you are welcome. I hope stakeholders are ready for submissions. We'll start with the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, SAICA. Each stakeholder is allocated...
Pardon? How many minutes? Is it 10? Yes. Stakeholders are business 10 minutes. So we'll take South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, like the platform.
Thank you, Honourable Karim and Honourable Mashlangi, we appreciate it. This is Peter Farber and Sharon Smulders from SAICA. Thank you for affording us the opportunity to discuss the tax bills. As we all know, South Africa's economy is under severe pressure, both with high unemployment, increasing inequality, outbound investment looking at four times more than the incoming money. So the President's role in this is to ensure and instill confidence, both from the local investors as well as foreign investors. And the way in which he can do this is policy certainty and investor confidence. Now, if we've looked at the amendments throughout the bill, taking these two core principles into account, and there's a few sections that we want to discuss, and they're up there, and we'll go through each of them individually, and apologies, I know you can't see that. It's quite small. Okay, so if we start with policy certainty, now we know that this is one of the requirements of a good tax system, and without this, it underpins the economy. So what this actually means is that a taxpayer must know in advance how much he must pay, when he must pay it, and in what manner he should be paying his tax. Now, unfortunately, some of the amendments that were brought into the bills were brought into account retrospectively. Now, this means that in some cases, legitimate transactions are now being caught, and it might result in some taxpayers being non-compliant, and it might even force them to have to pay interest and penalties. So we've listed a few sections there that you can have a look at. And again, our submission here is that these retrospective changes should only occur or should not be happening if it's to the detriment of taxpayers. And this will uphold the core principles of a tax system. Now, one of the other principles of a tax system is that it's got to be efficient and effective. And this is to ensure that the benefits of complying with the tax law does exceed the costs of actually complying. Now, why is this important, the cost to actually comply? Because we've seen that it does affect economic behavior. It does result in the company having less money to actually expand the business or employ more people. And it also, research has shown that compliance costs actually can instill behavior that we don't want. It can affect tax compliance behavior, and in some cases actually lead to evasion. So we went through the amendments, and there's a few, and I've listed a few there, where we actually can see that taxpayers are going to have to spend considerable time and cost to become and remain compliant. So the examples are, for instance, the trading stock provisions, where taxpayers are now required to keep records of the value of trading stock, both for accounting and tax perspective, where they could just be keeping one. The PBOs are now required to actually register as a normal taxpayer because they can get tax exemption status. Section 31 effective transaction changes are very complex and lead to uncertainty, which will increase the cost of investor funding into South Africa. I'll chat a bit later about Section 72 VAT hardship ruling. If that's taken away, a lot of taxpayers are going to have to incur substantial changes to their system. So here again, we're just asking that National Treasury consider the effect of these changes on the taxpayer's compliance costs, because if these costs are excessive, it might affect tax compliance behavior, and that's definitely not something what South Africa can afford at this stage. Now, as we said before, investors require policy stability and certainty. Now, we went through the Act, the bills as well, and we found a few sections where this is not actually happening. The first one I'd like to chat about is the special economic zones. Now, this section was brought in to promote investment in South African economic growth. However, what we're seeing now is that the requirement or the change proposed is that only new companies and expansions on new companies will be allowed after the SEC Act was brought into account, will be allowed to access this incentive. Now, what happened was before the SEC rules came into place, we had the IDC rules, and certain companies were set up in that, and they were meant to be transferred across to the SEZ rules. Certain companies also started setting up in the SEZ areas before the law actually became effective. It started about 2013-14, but was only actually promulgated in 2016. Now, all of those companies will not have access to this particular incentive anymore, and we're asking that they are included in the proposed changes. Another criteria that they've introduced with this change is that the gross income of these particular entities must be increased by 100% in gross income at the height of the last preceding 3 years. Now, if we look at that, that is really stringent requirements, and we doubt that many of those that are currently there are actually going to meet these criteria. So again, we're just asking that we have a look at this so that we're not excluding people that are entitled to this or should be entitled to this particular incentive. Another one that concerns us is the venture capital company regime. Again, the whole reason behind this was to promote investment into small enterprises that couldn't get normal funding. So what used to happen is investors used to invest into the venture capital companies. They used to get a upfront tax deduction for this investment. The venture capital company took this money and then invested in SMEs. Now, the change proposed here is that they're going to limit the tax deduction that the investors can get when they invest into a venture capital company. Now, the effective date of this is the 21st of July 2019, which again can result in certain venture capital companies falling foul of the provisions and no longer being compliant with Section 12J, which again could lead to certain penalties being incurred. The other concern is that potential investors will think twice before actually investing in venture capital company regimes again because of the change in policy. So our suggestion here is to rather than limit the investment into the venture capital company, rather limit what the venture capital companies are investing in, rather than prohibiting the actual investment into the VCC. Because again, this takes away the certainty of the policy. Again, we said tax policy should ensure that interpretation of the law is clear for ordinary person to understand, and that doesn't seem to be happening at this stage with the change to the definition of associated enterprise in Section 31. They've introduced the OECD definition, which is very broad and unclear, and we need a domestic law clarification, and again, just to provide certainty to the investors. The dividend strippings, again, our concern here is that it's very broad. The application will, at this stage, include certain legitimate transactions that we feel should be carved out of these specific provisions. Then if we look at Section 72, the initial intention with this section was to allow the Commissioner the discretion to make a decision or arrangement where taxpayers had difficulties or incongruencies in complying with the VAT Act. Now, the effect here is that the effective date is the 21st of July, and we had certain uncertainty here. What does this mean for those rulings or decisions that were in place already? Are they stopped from here? Do they carry on and run their course? What is actually going to happen to these things? But thankfully, we did hear at the National Treasury Workshop that they will be looking at transitional provisions to cater for these rulings that are already in place. And as I mentioned before, there's certain changes that would need to take place if this section is changed. Another concern that we have is that the proposed amendment is saying that this section will only be applicable if there are similar difficulties that have arisen from any other...
Sorry. Unfortunately, I'm back here from the NCOP side, right?
Yes.
Unfortunately, also, the committee chair has a major urgent matter to attend to.
Okay.
So he's asked me to just to chair for a while, which means you've got to stick to your 10 minutes, right?
Yeah.
So unfortunately, because I didn't know how to do this job, I don't know when you started.
We've
but
got
it's more or less
7 minutes.
On seven. So at 8, I don't need to tell you, right? So can you please note that everybody at 8 minutes, I'll let you know when I'm chairing. And then remember, we are just here incidentally. Can we stress that to the dentist there, right? We are incidentally, just to explain our role, right? These bills are in the NA side. On the NCOP side, we will deal with our own independent process, okay? So we our job here is more to listen. We don't get too involved. But given that the chairperson has a major political responsibility he has to attend, I'll just chair this session for a while. Then can we please stick to the old rules? Those of you who are with us before, you know how it is. 8 minutes, you're alerted. 10 minutes, you've got to stop. Okay? And just to remind them, for new members on the standing committee side, the researchers look at every submission. The chairs and whips look at every submission. You know, we go through it. Not that we always understand it, but we go through it. So that will still be done, I'm sure. There won't be a change. The chairperson is very familiar with parliamentary processes. So you've got 3 minutes. Thank you. I'm going to monitor you from now, right?
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Karim. Okay, so the one proposed change is that this section will only be applicable if there are similar difficulties that have arisen for any other vendor of the same kind and who makes similar suppliers. Now, the concern is we don't actually know what they mean by similar difficulties, similar vendors, so we need certain clarity on that. And also, the onus is on the taxpayers to actually find other people with a similar problem, and that might cause problems with confidential transactions. You don't want to go to a competitor and ask, do you have the same problem? And also, what about the actual unique situations where there aren't any other vendors with particular problems, such as state-owned enterprises? What actually happens in these circumstances? Okay, I'm going to hand over to Peter, who will discuss the exempt PBOs.
Thanks, Sharon. Let's see if I can do it in 30 seconds. Honourable members, I think the big thing here with when we deal with tax-exempt, especially public benefit organisations, is the fact that these are entities that don't necessarily are able to represent themselves. They don't necessarily have the money to do so. What the proposal here is essentially to remove the retrospective approval for these entities to be able to become exempt. Now, in 2009, there was a policy change in regard to this matter, where we saw that National Treasury actually acceded to the fact that even though there is a compliance necessity, there's also a reality that these organizations cannot necessarily look after themselves. I mean, these are people who start feeding schemes, etc., out of somebody's house. What this provision, and it's unfortunate that SARS has already implemented this legislation on their forms, even though it's not gone through Parliament, is to allow these organizations to become compliant, and then the result of this amendment would be that these entities are treated as normal tax-paying companies liable to tax until such time as they then get approval. And I think it is something we really need to reconsider given our own reality and the reality of this sector. The last is just comments, members, on the foreign remuneration exemption. I think, one, we'd like to reiterate the fact that I think the discussions have been quite heated, especially in the media, etc. We'd like to reiterate our position we took when this was proposed, that we need to separate the discussion between local and foreign employers. I think it's been confusing the issue quite a lot. And secondly, we just like to note that we are quite concerned about a lot of misinformation and disinformation currently in the market on this. I know currently there's actually even a matter in front of court at the moment where one of these professional advisors are taking exception to the fact that their positions are being criticized. And I think it is a bit disingenuous in relying on fear in regard to this position. And I think we need to get to the real facts and economic realities regarding this position, and hopefully it will clarify. Thank you very much.
Next is the Minerals Council. Remember, Treasury will come back and respond. You'll have a chance to respond, and then our staff will put together a report. Who's Mineral Council? Okay, they're late. So next then is Price Waterhouse, is that right? Yes, but they're not here, unfortunately. Yeah, you can go ahead. You've been here thousands of years. You can manage. Yeah, okay, thank you. Bye.
Yep. Thank you, Chair. By way of introduction, my name is Carl Mann. I'm the tax policy leader at PwC. It's a warm word of welcome to the new committee, and I certainly look forward to working with you over the course of the next few years going forward. Just a few items on our agenda that we want to highlight that are in this year's tax bills. I'm not going to go through all of them in detail because, number one, I don't have the time to do so, and number two, I don't think you want to hear my boring voice for more than the 10 minutes. So I'll just try and highlight these specific issues to you and would then ask that the committee applies its mind, the committees apply their minds further to these issues. The first issue is in relation to what is colloquially referred to as the anti-dividend stripping rules in the legislation. Now, this has been an ongoing thing for the last 2 or 3 years in terms of Treasury trying to get these rules right. But very briefly, by way of background and in very simple terms, what this refers to is a situation where instead of selling shares, a company has essentially just stripped out the value of those shares through tax-free dividends, which are usually then only funded through by means of a new shareholder coming into the company and either diluting the existing shareholder, which is the subject matter of this year's proposed amendments, or the existing shareholder exiting in his entirety. So this year's amendments, as I alluded to, are aimed at addressing the situation where there's a dilution of the existing shareholder as opposed to an outright exit. And the very simple reason why that is, why Treasury needs to address that is because there is no tax event otherwise, which in order to trigger tax, there needs to be, certainly from a CGT point of view, there needs to be a disposal event, which is it's possible then to do a dilution without actually having such an event. So that is what Treasury is trying to address this year. The concern that we have with these rules, and this goes beyond just this year's proposed amendments, is the extremely broad and overly broad application of the rules and the implications it has. So what happens is that these rules impact on transactions which we suggest are not abusive and should not be impacted at all, and we see them as unintended collateral damage. And those include such things as certain BEE transactions that have been done where the value of the shares is being purposefully stripped out in order to make those transactions more affordable from a BEE point of view, and similar situations when it comes to, for example, employee share ownership plans, again, where very often shares are issued at a discount to the true underlying value. The problem that we foresee with this is that these rules are not, there's no linkage, if you like, between the dividend being paid to the existing shareholder and how those are funded essentially by the new shareholder coming in. And that's the fundamental problem the fundamental issue that's causing all of these problems in the legislation. It's a design issue. So what we would like to see is that sorted out, which will in its entirety, and we're more than happy to work with Treasury, as we've done in the past, to help them design the legislation to address that while avoiding the collateral damage that these provisions are causing elsewhere. The second issue is in relation to special economic zones. There are two concerns there that Treasury has raised, and that the first being whether or not these are truly new businesses, if you like, or expansions of existing businesses which are going into the special economic zones. Treasury are proposing to put in specific rules around that. We don't believe that that's necessary. We believe that there are sufficient governance and approval processes in place from the SEZ side themselves. So we would certainly like to see those withdrawn, as though we don't believe that's necessary. The second element is around concern, and this is a valid concern, with the potential for shifting of profits from outside the SEZ from related parties to operations inside the SEZ. The trouble comes with the manner in which Treasury are proposing to deal with that, which we don't believe is appropriate. So they're introducing a hard, very objective test, which is going to potentially, in many respects, undermine the very purpose of the incentive by making it far less attractive, considering, bearing in mind that the purpose of the incentive is to attract investment into these SEZs. So if you're going to dilute the effective tax rate, increase the effective tax rate, it's going to make it less attractive for companies to invest in those SEZs. The solution, we believe, is to introduce domestic transfer pricing rules to apply to any company in an SEZ. We believe that that is purposely feasible. Treasury's pushback has been that there's a lack of capacity and source, but quite frankly, the rule that they are proposing to introduce is going to be even more administratively and compliance, and a greater compliance burden for taxpayers as well. So we don't believe that those comments coming from Treasury are valid in this context, and that transfer pricing is the appropriate instrument to be using here. Section 12J, I'm not going to get into a long discussion of it. There are persons here who are far more qualified to get into the detail of this. All I want to do is implore the committee to carefully consider the broader implications of what Treasury is proposing here. And those broader implications go to what the impact is going to be on the funding of small and medium businesses going forward, and ultimately what the long-term impact is on investment, economic growth, and job creation. I get the impression that Treasury is taking a very narrow, short-term view in relation to this, looking purely at what the revenue impact is without fully considering the long-term economic implications of what is being proposed with the introduction of this cap. But I'll leave it there and for the other commentators to elaborate on. The next issue is around related to transfer pricing, where Treasury are proposing to introduce a new associated enterprise test, if you like, as to whether or not transfer pricing is applicable between on cross-border transactions. As members may be aware, currently what the requirement is that there must be cross-border transactions between connected persons, which is a domestic definition. Treasury's concern is that definition doesn't go far enough in some respects when it comes to transfer pricing, because you can have common control, if you like, or economically connected entities which strictly speaking are not connected persons. So they're proposing to extend this the transfer pricing rules to the so-called associated enterprises, which is a double tax treaty concept. It's not a definition in itself, and that's where the concern comes in. It's that being a concept, it tends to be very broad and vague in its language, and introducing that into our transfer pricing legislation is going to create a lot of uncertainty. So we don't believe it's appropriate. We certainly understand Treasury's concerns, But we believe the far better way of dealing with that would be, at least for transfer pricing purposes, to then expand the definition of a connected person to more closely target the actual areas of concern that do exist, rather than this very vague concept. The final issue that I want to deal with, which Saka has already touched on, is Section 72 of the VAT Act. In relation to this proposal, we don't have any real concerns or principle around the fundamentals, if you like, of the proposed amendments. We understand the rationale for it, and we believe that that rationale is, in many respects, is valid. We do share some concerns that were raised by SACA, but I believe that those are more from an interpretive point of view in terms of how this provision would be applied in practice, as opposed to a problem with the legislation itself. The concerns that we do have, though, if you like, are essentially transitional issues. One concern is that the proposed effective date for this provision is retrospective to the date that the legislation was, the draft legislation was published for comment. The concern there is that we, as we understand it, SARS is now, in relation to new applications that have been made, effectively applying this legislation, notwithstanding that this is not law yet, and we would suggest it's actually unlawful for them to be applying it, given that it has not been promulgated. What they really should be doing is applying the existing law as it stands. The problem being, though, that the proposal is that this is retrospective, but life goes on. And applications continue to be made, and SARS is obliged to consider considering those.
There are 10 minutes, as you well know, but I'll give you a minute more. Right?
Thank you. I'm on my very last point, Chair. The second issue then that is in relation to what is the status of the existing decisions that have been made under Section 72. Now, last week there was some very robust discussion around this. And one of the suggestions was that there should be some transitional rules. We believe that that should be the case. We do need to see, we can't just have a hard cut-off on this, whereby existing decisions are essentially made redundant. We do need to see a process whereby those are transitioned into the new regime. That's me done. Thank you, Chair.
Accountants, you've taken 30 seconds of yours. You can negotiate for that. Okay, over now to Tisa. Mineral Council, welcome. You're on next, okay? We heard you were late. Right. 10 minutes. At 8 minutes, I will let you know that your time's lapsing. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Chair, thank you very much. And I see the Chair is back as well. Last year, Honourable Karim invited me to speak about the illicit trade in tobacco and given an overview of the size and scope of the illicit trade in tobacco and how much government is losing. And I want to congratulate the committee for the work they've done afterward that through the rest of the year. And thank you for the opportunity here again today. Today I'm here to make a proposal on a tax issue, Honourable Members, which we believe could mean more income for the state. And I would motivate it why. The Tobacco Institute, I'm not going to go through that, you can see that, but we represent the whole value chain of the legal tobacco industry in this country. This is an industry generating more than 54 billion rand of economic activity. It's a significant taxpayer in this country, and it's a significant job provider, especially on the agricultural side in deep rural areas. So it's an important sector in our country in many respects. Chair, TISA calls for a cigarette excise duty freeze. It sounds like contradicting to what I've said, because I want to make a proposal that can increase the income for the state, so why a freeze? But I'll tell you why. In theory, price is a good mechanism to curb tobacco consumption. That's true, and deter access, especially to the youth. So the higher the price, the more difficult it is for people to use the tobacco products, and that is what government's intention is from a health perspective. As the legal tobacco industry, we support this principle because tobacco is harmful, and the state needs the income. But the condition, honourable members, is that the playing field must be level. And as long as we do not have a level playing field, we will not increase the income for the state. Let's look at the reality in the South African market, apart from the theory, is that tax compliance in the cigarette industry is at very low levels. There's a legal and an illegal industry. There's these parallel industries in our country, us making the contribution, the illegal industry robbing this country of billions, and also making the health agenda go out of the window because of cheap, unregulated products in the market. There's also weak enforcement despite good intentions. Since Mark Kingan became acting commissioner of SARS, he really started doing good things, him and his team, and we trust that the new commissioner will continue with that, but these things will take time. But at the moment, there is still very, very weak enforcement. And we can say tax is an enforcement issue, that's true, but that'll take time, but there's also other measures that can be taken. Chair, in 2018, as you know, if the Ipsos study found that 42% of the informal market is illegal, costing the state last year $8 billion in one year alone. If you don't want to believe the studies, let's look at it from a different perspective. South Africans smoke between 31 and 35 billion cigarettes a year, and Treasury's got the numbers. Maximum, they collect tax on 17 to 19 billion cigarettes only. That's a maximum. But they've got the numbers. That leaves a gap of at least 12 billion cigarettes out there which South Africans smoke, which they buy cheaply, and which is costing the fiscus more than 11 billion rand. So it's even more than the Ipsos study at 8 billion, and that's just in 1 year. It's generally accepted worldwide, honourable members, that there's a direct link between higher taxes or higher prices and the illicit trade. And the only reason is because there's an incentive to make money. Tobacco is a highly taxed product. If you don't pay the taxes, that's the incentive, and that's the profit that goes into illicit operators' pockets, and that is why they can put the products on the market for cheap. I can give you this statistic that excise on cigarettes increased in South Africa from 4.53 in 24, that's 4.53 excise on a packet of 20, to today 16.66 on a packet of 20. That's an increase of 267% over the 15 years, or an average of almost 18% per annum. Three times inflation increases on average over 15 years. And on a price of, to make it real for you, on a price of 35, which is a legal packet of cigarettes on the low end, tax represents 21.22 that goes to government, or 60% in taxes. On a packet of cigarettes costing 40 rand, honourable chair members, 21.87 on the last bullet there goes to government, or almost 55%. So government is a real big stakeholder or shareholder almost in the tobacco industry, ranging from 54 to 60% on taxes on a legal packet of cigarettes going to government. The rest of that price is shared in the value chain between farmers, leaf, paper, retailers, wholesalers, manufacturers, margins, distributions, and all those good things. So just to show you how big the incentive is if taxes are avoided. This is a slide I was presented last year, as you know. This is a slide that Treasury showed last year in the same session that I presented. And you can see, honourable members, that the graph goes up and up and up and up through the years. But Treasury themselves predicted 2017 to 2018 a drastic decline in income from tobacco, despite increases annually by the Minister of Finance in excise. So it's that last straw that breaks the camel's back. Taxes went higher and higher and higher, and then it becomes too high. The price of legal products becomes too high. It creates a gap in the market for tax avoidance, and there are so many cheap products. And Treasury actually reported a drastic reduction in income from tobacco. Because the price elasticity on cigarettes, honourable members, could always absorb higher and higher taxes. I showed you how much it increased. Elasticity was such a nature that it could absorb that, but it reached a peak. And that's why it broke the camel's back and the income graph went the other way. Consumers reverting to cheap illegal products because it's available in the market. And your legal products are expensive because 50 to 60% tax incidence on that. Any further increase in excise duties, honourable members, we firmly believe will, and it's not we believe, it's a reality, will create even a larger gap between your legal products and your illegal products. The incentive becomes bigger. The illegal operators just make more money. The only people who will comply with the higher taxes is the legal industry. They will always comply because that's a legally compliant industry. But their products will become so expensive that that wrath of Treasury will just decline further. South Africa has the potential, honourable members, and this is not a threat, but it is true, that if the legal industry disappears or the legal products disappear or become so small, the total market can be supplied by illicit operators. This total market of 35 billion cigarettes can be cheap, unregulated products out there in the market. The youth can have access, the government's health agenda will go out the window, and the fiscus will lose just about everything from tobacco. The logic argument, therefore, in the numbers tell us, honourable members, that excise should be lowered or kept at current levels. And this will increase, actually, the income for the state, we believe, because the current or the incentive for tax avoidance will be less. Your legal industry will pay the same. They will regain volumes back. And as your enforcement picks up, there will be a double benefit for the state and for the legal industry. SARS has good intentions to clamp down on illegal cigarettes, but this will take time. I have to stress the point that that will not happen overnight. It will take a year, 2-3 years before SARS has come to full grips with tackling the illegal industry and actually eradicating it. Also, a coordinated effort is required. This SARS is the tax collector and it's their mandate. But tax avoidance is a crime. And a concerted effort needs to be made by SARS, SAPS, the DPCI, the NPA, the AFU. Honourable Chair, we plead, therefore, in the interest of the health agenda, which I've touched on, the income to the fiscus, which I've touched on, the interest of the legal industry, which is contributing in this country, for an excise freeze on an urgent basis for at least 3 years or until all cigarettes in the market are tax-paid. We also offer our assistance to SARS once again, and we plead with SARS to accept our offers. Do you need forensic auditors? Because the illicit products in South Africa are not smuggled products. They are not counterfeit products, as is generally being told. They are manufactured by factories in South Africa, registered and licensed by SARS, but they do not pay the taxes. We are happy to offer SARS forensic auditors, training of experts, and we plead also with SARS to accept our offer of assistance in the true spirit of a public-private partnership. I thank you very much, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members.
Minerals Council, over to you. While you're making your way here, can I just draw people's attention to this? With Section 75 bills, can you please come to the front? Can somebody help Alan or somebody? Because we're losing time. Yeah. Do you realize that Section 75 bills, the NCOP is a very limited role. So you've got to lobby on this side and present your case on this side. Because by the time it comes to us, there's very limited space we have in terms of the law, except on 76 bills, to make changes. So I'm alerting you to that, right, in case you think that you can coast on this side and then come to the NCOP. Having said that, Minerals Council, can you start, please? Thank you. Welcome. You'll introduce yourselves quickly and then get me in play. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Nick Lesufi. I'm a senior executive at the Minerals Council. I'm accompanied by my colleagues. On my left is Ashla Brown, who is the head of legal at the Minerals Council, and Bongani Mota. He's a senior policy analyst and in the economics division, and Tafazwa, who's Tafi, who's another economist in the Minerals Council. Now, who is the Minerals Council? The Minerals Council is the former Chamber of Mines. We are a voluntary association of mining companies. We represent more than 70 large, medium-sized, and small and medium mineral companies. We represent over 200 entities That is the more than 70 members represents about 200 entities. We contribute significantly to the economy. Now, the Minerals Council and its members are not climate change denialists and fully understand the science of climate change. We are fully supportive of a measured transition to a low emission economy and of South Africa's commitment to reducing greenhouse gas emissions in line with our commitment in terms of the Paris Agreement. We emphasize that a transition to a carbon economy must be balanced with a need for a competitive tax system, which is critical for investment in capital-intensive industries such as mining. Mining projects involve high-risk exploration outlays, large upfront capital commitments, long-life assets, sophisticated technologies, and long lead times to profitability. We also emphasize that the socio-economic implication of the carbon tax and regulatory uncertainty, which negatively impacts on the competitiveness of the mining industry, remain significant concerns. Today, the Minerals Council is going to focus on two key issues. First, the various issues of amendment of the taxation legislation that impacts on the carbon tax and its implementation. And secondly, we are going to highlight some of the impacts of the carbon tax on the mining industry. The Minerals Council has been part and parcel of the BUSA submission and therefore support the views expressed by BUSA and its member companies and associations. At this instance, I'll hand over to Ashla Brown to discuss the specific term, our submission on the draft taxation laws amendment bill.
Good morning, everyone. The first issue deals with the amendments to the Carbon Tax Act, specifically Section 3 of the Act. We do not support that amendment given the fact that the amendment seeks to align the emission thresholds to what is defined in the technical guidelines. Our big concern here, Chair, is that the technical guidelines emanate from the greenhouse gas emission regulations, and the greenhouse gas emission regulations refers to the thresholds as above and not equal to or above. We ask that the legislator be consistent and use terminology that is aligned to regulatory instruments, and therefore we recommend that the amendment in Section 3 must be aligned with the amendment in the greenhouse gas emission regulations. With regard to the amendment of Section 4 of the Carbon Tax Act, I think, Chair, what we have here is a problem around the structure of the amendment as proposed in the Act. This amendment seeks to ensure that if a company has specific emission factors that have been determined by DEF, then those emissions factors should apply and not the IPCC guideline or country-specific emission factors, which is your Tier 1 and Tier 2 factors. However, the way the amendment is structured, it says that your country-specific amendment is subject to these Tier 1 and Tier 2 emissions, which means that irrespective of whether you've got company-specific factors approved, you still have to apply either the IPCC or the country-specific factors. With regard to the amendment proposed in Section 5, we again also do not propose this amendment because what it seeks to do is to allow for annual adjustments to the tax rate of the carbon tax. You would know that the Carbon Tax Act seeks to actually regulate behavior, And we believe that it's necessary that we first need to understand the effectiveness of the current provisions before further amendments to a unilateral adjustment is effected. With regard to the technical amendments, we don't have a problem with the amendment as proposed in Schedule 2, which seeks to allow for the adjustment of process emissions by separating the initial 70% into 60% under basic allowance and 10% under basic allowance for process emissions. However, the way the formula is structured suggests that the process emission value will be reduced by the full 70%, which is the basic allowance for cement production, and that does not give effect to the intention that the amendment seeks to achieve. We just ask that there's a look at the formula, and we have proposed what the revised formula should be. With regard to the amendments proposed in the Income Tax Act, we do not support the blanket repeal of Section 12K. We do not have a problem to ensure that there is no double benefit that will result to the taxpayer. However, this amendment assumes that the taxpayer who qualifies for an exemption under the Income Tax Act is the same taxpayer who will qualify for carbon tax offset under the Carbon Tax Act. So, in our view, there will be specific instances where the person who generates the credit, the carbon credit, might sell it to a third party, who, for instance, might be a foreigner who's not entitled to allowance under the Carbon Tax Act, but then they will still be denied the benefit under the Income Tax Act. So we ask for a specific carve-out to ensure that Section 12K only applies to those instances where a double benefit arrives. The amendment with regard to Section 12L, we welcome the extension of the energy efficiency tax incentives period to 2022. However, we point out that this period might be inadequate. Currently, to invest in energy efficient projects, it takes a long time, and the 2022 period termination period.
You're close to 10 minutes.
Sorry.
Just to 10 minutes.
Sure, thank you, Chair. Thank
you, Chair. I think just in conclusion, we have made a presentation. I think we have distributed the presentation. People can read there. But I think our main concern are the ones that we have raised here, and our stinting concerns in terms of the global impact of climate of carbon tax per se. We still have our discussions with the National Treasurer. Thank you very much.
You were not here, but we explained the process. It's quite, we don't just, this is only part of it. Our researchers are here. We have a tax expert who will put all the stuff together, and there will be responses from Treasury, so, you know, and so on. So can we have 12J?
Sure.
Just waiting for the presentation.
Sure.
Good morning, Honourable Karim, Honourable Members, Members of National Treasury and stakeholders. Thank you very much for giving us some time to speak and address you this morning. By way of introduction, my name is Dino Zuccolo. I am the chairman of the newly founded 12J Association of South Africa. We established this association in early 2019 amongst approximately 25 different asset managers who represent more than 40 Section 12J companies and about 5.7 billion rand of 12J AUM, or 70% of the industry, with two main objectives as a mandate. The first is to educate the public as regards the 12J incentive and the success it's been having in South Africa, as well as to act as a point of contact for engagement with National Treasury, members of Parliament, and so forth. Another key output that we as the Association are currently working on is that we've conducted an industry survey amongst all of our members in order to try and better understand the impact that 12J is having in South Africa, and we've also retained PricewaterhouseCoopers in order to take that data and put together a report which we intend to present to Treasury and Parliament in the coming months. Maybe just to contextualise the current discussion, although you'll well know this, 12J was introduced by National Treasury and Parliament in 2009 with an intention of boosting private investment in SMMEs around South Africa. Although it was introduced in 2009, not much happened in South Africa until certain changes were made to the law. Specifically, initially when 12J was brought about, there was a cap on how much someone could invest in a 12J company in any year of assessment. When National Treasury moved to remove that cap, what happened was 12J as an asset class really started to gain traction, specifically from 2015. And to date, there's been a really good uptake of the incentive. There's been about 8.3 billion rands worth of capital raised. That capital has begun to be deployed within the South African economy. We've had more than 3.5 billion rand put into underlying investments. And that really has catalyzed what is the beginning of the growth of a vibrant small, medium, and micro-sized enterprise sector in South Africa. I think, conversely, we are the first to state and to agree with Treasury that there has been abuse of the incentive. And kudos to Treasury, who in 2018, through the TLAB process, effectively shut that abuse down. Although, of course, because 12J companies have 36 months to spend the money that they've raised, the impacts of the changes made by National Treasury will only really start to come through in the following 2 years. Maybe just to touch very briefly on what we believe to be some of the key benefits of Section 12J in the South African economy is that, in our view, Section 12J is one of the few mechanisms available in South Africa at the moment which promotes five-year lock-up capital in South Africa in the context of ultra-high net worth and high net worth individuals externalizing a lot of their capital. 12J has created an incentive and a mechanism whereby those individuals are incentivized to keep their money in South Africa. What the impact is of that money having been retained within South Africa, as I've alluded to earlier, is the beginning of a vibrant, high net worth funded SMME sector in South Africa, which previously did not exist. And as we know, SMMEs in South Africa account for between 70 and 80% of employment in the country. To give members of Parliament an example as to where the funds that have been raised into Section 12J have been spent, it is in things such as renewable energy, student accommodation, hotels and hospitality, agriculture, education, tech startups and the like. And we believe these all to be sectors which are desperately in need of capital in South Africa. What this capital has done in the end is it's assisted economic growth in South Africa, it's assisted mentorship of SMMEs, and ultimately job creation, which is so desperately needed in South Africa at the moment. I think one thing that's really important to note about 12J is there's been a lot of focus on the fact that 12J gives investors an upfront tax deduction. When you invest in a 12J company, you get to deduct against your income whatever you have contributed to that company. But there isn't focus on the fact that there is a lot of tax that is paid during the five-year investment period within Section 12J structures. As an example, the 12J manager pays tax. The underlying 12J investments pay tax. They pay VAT on income earned. When we make distributions to our investors, we pay dividends withholding tax. And of course, when you exit a Section 12J company, there is a CGT consequence from a base cost of zero. And as a result, it's worth pointing out to members of Parliament and National Treasury that the actual cost to the fiscus of Section 12J is much lower than the initial upfront tax deduction. National Treasury, in an attempt to manage cash flow, have proposed a cap, or the reintroduction of a cap of 2.5 million rand per investor per year in a Section 12J company by way of the 2019 draft TLAB. What we'd like to do is point out a couple of our concerns as regards this proposed cap, starting off with the fact that whilst we agree with the logic of the concept of a cap that Treasury have proposed, We do not agree with the way in which that cap has been calculated. Our understanding of the calculation of the cap is that it's been based on an arithmetic average, i.e. how much has been raised and how many investors are there in the incentive. The reality of the way that funds are raised in Section 12J is that we raise a lot of money from a few investors, and a large number of investors contributes a very small amount towards the total AUM in the asset class. And as such, we would propose that when the cap is calculated, it's based on far more complicated arithmetic calculations than a simple average. In addition, we've surveyed our member base, and we understand that had this cap been retrospectively applied, the total size of the 12J industry in South Africa would have reduced by 70%, or about 4 billion rand. And of course, the consequential impact of that is that high net worth capital flows out of the SMME sector in South Africa and potentially out of South Africa as a whole. And of course, that in turn has a serious impact on job creation, on economic growth, and on the development of SMMEs in South Africa. One final point to point out is that because 12J companies have a 36-month period in order to deploy the capital that they've raised, the fact that this cap is being introduced now has the commercial impact of being retrospective in nature for many 12J managers, because some of these people have not yet finished raising capital in South Africa yet, because they've got 36 months to do so in accordance with the law. As a result, to move to what our proposal is as regards the cap, we've put forward two options for the consideration of the honourable members here today and National Treasury. SAFCA will speak later, the South African Venture Capital Association, and will talk to the fact that in our view and in SAFCA's view, the minimum viable size of a Section 12J fund is approximately 200 million rand. What that does is it allows the manager sufficient scale and sufficient size and sufficient fees in order to be able to achieve their business model. What we would propose as the 12J Association is that Treasury and Parliament move to introduce or implement a cap of 10% of the commercial minimum fund size of 200 million or 20 million rand per investor.
You're close to 8 minutes, right?
Thank you very much, Honourable Karim. The second option is that if this is not acceptable to members of Parliament, what we would propose is that a provision be put into the legislation for an anchor investor in a Section 12J company who may invest up to 20% of the size of the fund, or 40 million rand, with the remainder of investors being limited to a smaller amount, practically 5% of the fund, or 10 million rand per investor. We believe that these two proposals will sufficiently address Parliament and Treasury's concerns around the foregone tax base of the fiscus, but will still allow 12J as a sector to continue to grow and have an impact in South Africa. I think in closing, just four considerations to table today is that, this has been mentioned already, but the need for policy certainty is absolutely fundamental for us as an industry, because every time changes are made to the law, it creates uncertainty amongst investors and our underlying investees, and what that in turn does is requires us to change our business models. But really importantly, 12J has a sunset clause in June 2021, and as currently written, the incentive will not endure beyond that date. What that means is that should this cap come in, we have less than 2 years to adapt business models for a sector that may or may not be there in the future, and that really is difficult for us as industry. So we plead to Parliament and members of Treasury to reconsider the cap and to think very carefully about the impact that it has on South Africa and economic growth. And to point out again that 12J commercially has only been around for 4 years, although it was originally intended for 12. And as a result, the impact that that incentive has on the South African economy is yet to be fully felt. And we believe that if 12J could be extended beyond the June 2021 sunset clause, perhaps for the 12 years that it was originally intended to be around, this would have a significant positive impact in South Africa. Thank you very much, Honourable Members.
Here we are. Thank you. Look, I really like the way you presented your submission. It's a very nice slide presentation. It's a complex matter. You put it so nicely, also with pictures. I'm not saying, therefore, the others are not palatable, but you must remember we are not experts like you. And tax issues are very complex, and new members, I know, will find it quite challenging. So, you know, we've always said to you in the last term that, please, the onus is on you to put matters simply and clearly. And the more you do that, the better the opportunity to get what you want acceptable to the committee. Okay, having said that, over to members. We've got half an hour, and I'll monitor ourselves as well. So depending on number of speakers, we will allocate time accordingly. How many want to speak? So, Dion, I don't know everybody's name, so let's just say number one. Who's number two? Nobody else. All right, in that case, you've got half an hour, Dion. Oh, number two. So, right, you can have up to 15 minutes each, or 12 minutes each, so that... Yeah, because, I mean, nobody wants to use the time, Zolani. Okay, fine. Yeah,
I definitely don't need that long, thank you.
All right, let's be realistic, up to 10 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. To Saika, on slide number 19, you refer to the complexity for tax-exempt entities. Is this because the process is manual and therefore time-consuming, or is it the actual information that SARS needs? If the process was easy via e-filing, for example, would it still be a problem? Then to PwC, on slide 5, on section 12J, you mentioned that the proposed cap of 2.5 million will negatively impact on funding available to SMMEs. Are you proposing that there should not be a cap, or are you proposing a higher cap, or are you agreeing with 12J industry's proposals on the caps? Then to the Tobacco Institute. The problem with illicit cigarettes is a huge problem, we all know that, but alleviating the tax burden on the existing industry is unlikely to resolve this problem. Given the unfunded national health insurance proposals, would you be opposed to an NHI tax on your industry to offset the damage your industry does to the health of our nation? And then finally, for the 12J Industry Association, you said the impact of the incentive hasn't been fully felt in the economy because it hasn't been there for very long. Have you done any research at all as to what the positive impact on our economy might have been? Thanks, Chair.
Gordon, right?
Thank you very much. Just a couple of brief questions. To Saika, your presentation was helpful in that you made very specific proposals on specific sections as to what you'd like to see amended. And if I could ask the other presenters, in particular the Minerals Council, which spoke more generally about the bills before us more generally and didn't necessarily make the specific proposals, if you could send us which specific proposals you make and for which sections, and the same applies to the gentleman from the 12J Association. Then just on the Tobacco Institute, there does seem to be an inherent contradiction in your argument, if I may just probe that a little bit. You say, speaking about the Laffer curve, you're basically saying that the industry has reached the top of the Laffer curve and that is why revenues are starting to decline. And on the other hand, you also say that there's this extraordinary, almost endless elasticity, price elasticity of demand in tobacco products, that it's very inelastic. So I just don't understand that. That seems like a contradiction. If you could say a little bit more about how that works, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Anybody else? All right, shall we move on? Very quickly, the one matter that is very complex is the TISA matter. Now, there's a lot of factors and variables to sort of take into account, and you have to have trade-offs. So firstly, it seems to me at least, and it was certainly the view of the committee as a majority in the last term, that we can have differences of views on the health issues. Personally, I've made my issues clear about tobacco. But given that we are where we are and that tobacco smoking is legal, then as the finance committees, our job is to ensure the state gets the taxes that is due to it. The preoccupation of both committees for the last 5 years has been obsessively with transfer mispricing, illicit financial flows, the looting of the misrepresentations of what is due in tax by a lot of the private sector. Now, a lot of money is being lost, billions actually, to the revenue service by illicit tobacco. But there's also an organization that will come here and argue that actually they are the true representatives of the tobacco industry. They will say they are more demographically representative. So, you know, those political parties that are concerned to ensure the deracialization of the private sector actually become more empathetic. So we have to find the right balances between saying yes to deracialization, but whatever your skin color, you must pay the taxes that are due to the state. We can say yes, we are opposed to smoking for the health consequences, but given that smoking is legal, everybody must pay the taxes that are due and so on. So it's a difficult area. But one thing is absolutely clear. The South African Revenue Service, who's here from them here right now? Ah, yes, of course, the two of you. We have put pressure on you in the past. You have brought to a halt, under your previous commissioner, investigations into illicit tobacco. And you promised this committee that you've set up a new structure and you're moving on it. And at some stage in the quarterly reports, I would suggest, I can't prescribe, it's merely a suggestion, the Standing Committee on Finance needs to look at that and say, what have you done since you last appeared before the Standing Committee on Finance in the last quarter of the last fifth parliament? What have you done? Show proof that you're tackling this matter. So I'm just alerting you members that those are decisions that were taken by the previous committee. Whether you want to implement them or not is your call, but for what it's worth, there it is. Okay, over then to the members to respond. Thank you. Who's going first? Yes?
Thank you, Jay. In response to the question by Honourable George, the short answer is yes, even though it's a lot more complex than that. I think the one thing that's a bit of a misnomer is that tax-exempt entity legislation or taxation, they actually do pay, a lot of them do actually pay tax. It's actually a lot more complex because you actually have to separate various income streams and allocate them to... It's actually highly complex for a very uncomplex taxpayer to actually understand. So I think that is probably... The start of it. As you've noted, the process is very manual. Our understanding is there's about 56,000 exempt entities and about 8 assessors. Matchbox sums give you about 3 assessments per hour, per day, for the whole year, for each assessor, which manually is, I think, an impossible task for the TEU to actually manage that. There's also some, we've met with them and spoken, given some insights into our views on redesigning the return as well to assist them in actually identifying where things are going wrong. And I think that the problem is that at the moment there's not enough resource allocation to make one that system electronic and to actually do the redesign to make their jobs a lot easier in helping the system. But I think where we're going now with this proposal is actually making it worse by essentially turning these exempt entities into companies for them just to apply for exemption at a later stage, and then dealing with two essentially tax statuses over a period of time, which given the industry, in our view, is just going to make them less compliant, not more compliant.
Nick, respond? Tisa, don't you want to respond? Okay, we'll come back to you, Tisa. You're too slow, so let him speak here. Okay, fine, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members, for the question. And Chair, I think your summary of the situation was spot on. This is not whether we like tobacco or not. The reality is it's a legal product. We believe that adults over the age of 18 have the right to choose to use tobacco products, well knowing that it's harmful to your health. And as I said, there's around 35 billion cigarettes smoked in this country. What is important is the contribution of the legal industry's value chain, 8 to 10,000 jobs on farms with over 30,000 dependents of the legal industry, processors, manufacturers, wholesalers, retailers, the whole value chain. We often hear the president and the government speak about, let us keep the processing and the value adding in our country. That's exactly what tobacco does. We do not export, like, for example, countries like Malawi or Zimbabwe, most of the raw product, of the raw leaf. We keep it here, it's processed here, and the whole value adding is here. What is important, that all those 35 billion cigarettes smoked out there, or as much of them as possible, should be tax paid. so that government can receive the taxes. Tobacco is a very highly taxed product worldwide. I showed you 50 to 60% of a packet of cigarettes, depending on the price, goes to the fiscus. We have a dual industry in this country, and those who claim to be the real industry, well, independent studies, for example by Ipsos, have shown that they are responsible for the elephant in the room, as Acting Commissioner Mark Kingan said, and that is flooding the market with cheap, untaxed top products. The tax on cigarettes is paid when it leaves the manufacturer. The tax is not paid by the retailer and the small businessman. He pays the VAT. But the 16.66 rand per packet of cigarettes is paid when it leaves the manufacturer. And those manufacturers avoiding taxes are in this country, so they can't claim to be small independent players. Illegal cigarettes have made billionaires of the owners of those companies. To the question of would we be willing for an NHI tax on our industry, National Treasury's policy, as I understand it, is a no for ring fencing of any view. So we support that view. What is important, that tobacco is highly taxed. All cigarettes must be tax paid. And whether National Treasury decides to use a portion of that for the NHI, that's up to National Treasury to decide. But we do not support ring fencing. The taxes are already too high. The price elasticity, as I tried to explain, is on the lower end, so there's no contradiction here. The legal cigarettes, where 20 Rand on a packet is tax alone, 21, 22, 23 Rand, depending on the price. So the higher the price, the more consumers start saying, well, we simply can't pay this anymore. And because you have a gap and you have an illicit industry, consumers switch from expensive, legal, tax-paid products of high quality to low, unregulated, non-tax-paid products, and that's where the problem lies.
Okay, thank you.
At the lower end, on the lower end, the elasticity is still there. You can have a packet of cigarettes for 20, 21 Rand and you won't lose volumes. But on prices of 30, 40, 45 Rand as legal cigarettes cost, you can't absorb anything more. So an increase in excise will increase that gap and consumers will switch further. So our honest and respectful view is that keep the excise rates the same will equal more income for National Treasury.
Thanks, Kyle.
Thank you, Chair. So in relation to the question around 12J and what is our position in relation to whether there should be a cap or not, as a firm, we have no firm position, excuse the pun, firm position insofar as that's concerned. We're not in a position that the industry are to comment on what the implications of the cap or the relative size of the cap would be. So I think the industry themselves are best placed to comment on what would be the implications of the cap, what is a viable cap versus what is not a viable cap, and so on. One of the suggestions we did, however, make in our submissions to Treasury was around the question of what I referred to as a hard cap versus a soft cap, if you like. So currently it's proposed as a hard cap, which says if you invest more than 2.5 million Rand into a VCC, in a year of assessment, the excess you don't get a deduction for. It's very simple terms. Another way, which would be a softer approach, with whatever cap is introduced, would be to say, okay, well, if you invest more than, I'm just going to use the 2.5 million Rand as an example, given that it is in the legislation, in the draft legislation, if you invest more than 2.5 million Rand, well, we will give you a deduction of up to the 2.5 million Rand in the year investment, and the excess will roll over to the following year to allow you to deduct then in the following year. Now, what that does is align the position with whether you invested, let's say, 5 million Rand in year one versus the position where you invested 2.5 million Rand in year one and another 2.5 million Rand in year two. Okay. So it removes that distortion, at least, from the system. That's our position. Thank you.
Honourable George, thank you for the question around the industry being new and what data we have at this point in time. I think maybe just to stress the point, you know, of the 8.3 billion Rand that's been raised into Section 12J, only 3.5 billion has been spent. in accordance with the rules which give us 36 months to spend that money. Of the $3.5 billion that's been spent, most of that has been spent in the last 12 months. And of course, once one has made an investment into an underlying business, it then takes time for that business to grow and for the impact to start to be felt on the South African economy. So it stands to reason that, you know, we're really at the infancy and at the beginning of where we could go as an incentive. To speak to the research, as I mentioned when we started the presentation, we have retained PricewaterhouseCoopers to perform an industry survey for us, which will be completed in the coming month, hopefully. And that will be presented to Parliament and to Treasury by way of an electronic communication, which will give you all of the statistics. What I can speak to are initial indicative findings which have come out of the research, which would indicate, and this is subject to the final findings, that the incentive has created, inferred, and or sustained 27,000 jobs, and that for every 1 million rand invested into 12J, and just to be clear, that 1 million rand investment, when you consider an individual paying tax at 45%, and then you net off the 18% exit capital gains tax consequence, for every 1 million rand invested, that results in 270,000 rand foregone tax base to the fiscus, excluding the fact that there are taxes paid in the underlying investments and VAT and dividends withholding tax and so on. So for every 1 million rand invested in 12J, it has the potential to create 5 jobs. And what that translates to for the fiscus is 54,000 rand a job on an initial indicative basis. I think the final point is that there are similar regimes in places like the UK, Canada, Australia, and so on, and we can take learnings from the success of those regimes in those markets. For example, in the United Kingdom, just the amount of tax that the underlying investee companies pay in their equivalent of 12J companies is the same as the aggregate deductions that the entire incentive has granted in that market. And that's, of course, an established regime that's been around for many years and that's had time to mature and grow and create tax base. So we really are very firmly of the view that should 12J be given time as an incentive in South Africa, the ultimate long-term or medium-term benefits to Parliament and the fiscus could far outweigh the initial tax deductions that are granted to our investors. Thank you.
Thanks. We have Yanga Mputa here. She might want to respond in 3 minutes, then we're going to tie up, and the chair will take over from Standing Committee on Finance.
Thank you, Chair. I'll respond on 12J and Section 30, the PBOs, and Chris will respond on tobacco. On 12J, we said the issue of the introduction of the cap was based on the fact that there is an initial tax deduction and it impacts the expenditure in the fiscus. And then according to their statistics, they are saying that currently 8.3 billion has been given as a deduction, but only 3 billion has been invested on qualifying companies. So the 5 billion, they still have got to invest over a period of 36 months, of which we understand that is how the law is drafted. But based on the workshops, there are some commentators there who were proposing a cap of 5 million on individuals and 10 million on companies, because we had workshops on the 5th and 6th of September. So we, as I said last week, we will be guided by you regarding the cap. But the issue is the initial expenditure on the fiscus and the amount that is invested on the SMMEs, because currently now it's only one third. The second one here is on Section 30, the PBOs. That was a transitional measure. For instance, small PBOs, they do not even register for tax because they do not know. What happens is that, what we have seen is that there are those entities that register for tax and pay tax. And now come maybe after 8 years, more than the period of prescription, they say they qualify for exemption. So what we have seen is that SAIF has to pay back the income tax together with interest. And what we have found in this one case, the interest was more than the tax that was supposed to be paid to that taxpayer. So that is the issue. We understand that there are smaller PBOs, and we even said in the workshops we're going to consider some legislative amendments so as to assist the smaller PBOs in this regard.
We haven't much time. Jordan, we'll come in. Just let me finish quickly, and then we'll come to you.
Thank you, Chair. Just on the tobacco excise issues, I mean, we are very concerned, obviously, about the revenues. It would be a win if we got rid of the illicit economy and improved revenues. The reason we don't think this is as much of an elasticity problem is because we've got a very stable policy environment for this. We're trying to target 40% of the most popular brand as the targeted excise burden. So there is a target for this. We stayed at that target, and yet even without deviating from that target, there was a huge drop-off in revenues in those previous 4 years, which we really do think was an enforcement issue. So we do look at it carefully. We try and investigate what the elasticities are, but the regime in terms of how we set excise duty burden on tobacco has been quite stable for a while.
I just want to ask, ma'am, the argument that the 12J incentive is costing the fiscus and therefore negatively influencing what government can spend money on. I mean, I assume that that argument was considered when Treasury introduced the 12J incentive, because the whole point of the incentive was that you're going to forego some taxes in the present in the hope that these investments will kickstart economic growth to deliver higher revenue in the future, a bigger economy, and therefore higher revenue in the future. Now, the gentleman is arguing that the industry hasn't really had the time to prove that case, that model, and that they need to go through the full 36-month period. Treasury, in a very tight fiscal space, is arguing, but this, you know, we can't extend it further. We've got to, lower the caps because, we need more money to spend. Doesn't that undermine the very genesis of 12J?
A good question. Mm. Well, not that the others are not good, but what
when 12J was introduced, it had a cap of 750,000. That cap has always been there when it was introduced. And we saw that there was no uptake, so we removed the cap. So now when we removed the cap, the uptake was too much. Like you see that high net worth individuals and family offices, just before the year end, they disproportionately invest amounts into the VCC so that they can get a tax deduction. That's what we are seeing. So hence now we are reintroducing the cap. And as I've said that we are open to look at whether we can increase the cap or change the cap, but we require the cap. The cap was there when 12J was introduced.
Give 12J 30 seconds. You know why? This is only the start. Then she's going to reply, and then the chairperson will get mad at me, right? So can you please, quickly?
Just very briefly. So just one point to clarify is that, yes, there's been $8.3 billion raised into 12J, but that does not represent the foregone tax base to the fiscus. That is the total capital raised into 12J. The maximum possible foregone tax base to the fiscus is 45% of that, less the 18 that gets paid on the end. So just to be clear, the number is much smaller to the fiscus. I think the second thing is that whilst we understand National Treasury's need to manage cash flow, the very nature of 12J is that it takes money from high net worths and it gives it to the manager, and then it incentivizes us to then spend that money into SMEs generally run by less wealthy people in South Africa. At 2.5 million rand, the reality is that the large majority of the ultra-high net worth investors in this country are not interested. And so our view is that a 2.5 million rand cap undermines the very purpose of the incentive and will have a substantially negative impact in South Africa.
Quickly. 30 seconds, really.
Sorry, just very quickly. I mean, look, from our perspective, it's hugely difficult to see the benefits of this. Is it being used for the correct projects? We've seen examples where it isn't used for correct projects. It isn't used for lower-income SMEs who really are struggling. It's used for other types of projects, and it looks almost like an avoidance structure. The one thing we haven't spoken about is it undermines the progressivity of this entire system. You've got ultra-high net worth individuals and family offices getting a huge tax break, which they're obviously doing for tax reasons according to the end of the year. I've even seen 12Js that don't even advertise what you are investing under. It just says invest with us to get the tax break. So it is really something we need to look at this very carefully.
Look, very quickly before I hand over to the chairperson, very quickly, Minerals Council, can we suggest to National Treasury, look carefully at what they say, but also look carefully that they're not using these amendments that they're seeking as a basis to undermine the whole carbon tax matter. We've discussed carbon tax ad nauseum, Comrade Chair, ad nauseum last year. And at this stage, there's no signal from the majority party or from government that there's any regret about the carbon tax at this stage. You'll have to go and lobby. So what what they may have a case about National Treasury SARs is the alignment and so on and the consistency, all of the issues that we dealt with last year in an empirical form. But you will meet with them, presumably, and discuss this matter further. Okay, you'll get a chance when you meet with them, okay?
Sure.
But you want to say something for 30 seconds, to be fair?
Thank you, Chair. Just to reaffirm, those concerns that have been addressed in the past still remains, and it's still a critical concern. So there needs to be constructive engagement between Treasury and ourselves and other industries to see how these issues can be addressed, because you cannot implement a law, but you don't allow for the full scope of tools that enable that law to be implemented to be there, and that, for us, is a major problem.
Just to remind you, ultimately, it's Parliament that decides. You can engage with Treasury, but ultimately you can agree with them, but hey, you know what? Even if you two agree, Parliament may not agree, so they will call you back off whenever they need to. We're 3 minutes behind time, Chairperson. I very gladly relieve myself of this responsibility. Thank you. Over to you, Chair. It's a Section 75, but let me remind you. Can I be excused for 10 minutes? We've got a programming clash on the NCOP side that must be resolved now, so I'll have to be excused. But we will catch up. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Karim, Chairperson. Let's proceed with the submissions. The next one is JA Transaction Solutions. 10 minutes.
Hi, Chair. Thank you. I'm James Aitchison from JA Transaction Solutions. It's a transaction services firm that seeks to bridge the gap between mid-tier corporates and the various advisors from a corporate law, accounting, tax, etc. I've had the privilege of commenting to this committee for, I think, since 2002. The purpose, I'm just going to cover four different topics today, not all in detail. And I apologise, I see it's actually quite small up on the board. The first one I want to touch on, I think PwC raised, which is in the context of the anti-dividend stripping rules. And in fact, I'm going to have to revert to my own hard copy here because my eyes can't even read my own slide on board. I think, as PwC mentioned, I mean, this is an extension of the existing provisions which target pre-sale dividends and seeks to tax dilutionary transactions which would otherwise escape by virtue of there not being a tax event or a sale. I think there are some policy aspects there in terms of whether they should be taxed at all, but I think that's a discussion for another day. I think in the first instance, I think just to, from a benefit of the members' point of view, before these provisions can bite, a number of instances have to apply. You have to have a certain level of shareholding, which is the qualifying interest test. There has to have been or be an extraordinary dividend, which is the stripping element, and then there has to be the issue of new shares to an incoming shareholder other than the existing shareholder. I think the concern that we share with PwC is just the extent and the scope of the amended changes, and that there are a number of legitimate transactions that may well be inadvertently caught up in this. So we've listed there a number of those types of transactions where, for argument's sake, you may well have had a disposal of an asset of a business, distributed the proceeds out, and then you look to invest in something else, but you look to raise, for argument's sake, preference share funding, which is done, one, because the investment is a share investment, so it's not efficient to raise debt, and two, because you're looking to effectively enhance your IRR on the investment and use effectively funding capital rather than shareholder funds, which is a lot more expensive. Now, if you've got those circumstances that you have a decent-sized shareholding, the qualifying interest, and the dividend's gone out, the fact that you're then looking to invest and fund it through the issue of preference shares can cause an unwarranted tax, or in our view, certainly, an unwarranted tax event to arise. Likewise, the issue of new shares in the context of a share scheme can trigger this. Also of concern is that where you are effectively dividend stripping or capitalising by reason of complying with government legislation in other areas, whether that's, for example, in conducting a BEE scheme or whether it's for capital adequacy reasons in terms of either the banking regulations or the insurance regulations, again, these transactions can be caught up in the net and trigger issues. Two other ones that I'll touch on are rights issues. If there's a rights issue where you choose not to take up your rights, lo and behold, you can inadvertently trigger a tax event simply by not taking action. The other one I'm going to touch on, and the next slide goes through it, is an example of what we were in the process of approaching SARS for a ruling on at the time of the budget, which is I call it a live transaction, but to be honest with you right now, it's been comatose since February. In that we were acting for a large family office. They had set up a structure many years ago where it was owned effectively 50% by the family arm and 50% was the ownership was put for the benefit of philanthropic purposes under a philanthropic trust. Over the years, the growth has been somewhat more than was originally anticipated, and it's been causing governance issues. So we were looking to split that grouping apart in a tax-neutral way. And to put some numbers to this, the total portfolio is about 15 billion rand, of which 7.5 billion rand is earmarked for philanthropic purposes. And over the last 10 years, that distribution policy has seen in excess of half a billion rand go through to philanthropic aims. Now, as it stands, only the dividend growth on that is being capable of being distributed to philanthropic purposes. The capital of 7.5 billion is locked up because until February this year, it was going to be capable with a SARS ruling of being split apart, but this one has unfortunately been caught up in the proposed changes. The issues as we see them from a technical point of view are that in this particular instance there's a mismatch in the tests, in that to fall inside it you have to have this qualifying interest, which is calculated with reference to your holding plus all the holdings of all connected parties, but when the tax trigger comes along it's only by reference to your own holding. And that simple mismatch, if that were to be addressed, would it enable the 7.5 billion to be released for the philanthropic purposes? Separately, there is a secondary issue that where this is triggered, you actually end up in a worse position than if you'd done an actual sale. Had you done an actual sale, you would have a deduction for your base cost or your cost of investment, but the way the legislation is drafted, the entire proceeds are deemed to be taxable. And I think PwC touched on the third point there, that what's missing in the legislation is some form of linkage, be that direct or indirect, between an incoming different shareholder and the distribution. I think lastly on that slide I'll just touch on, in 2017 the Treasury identified and did some changes, but there they put in an effective date that said if your transaction was effectively done and dusted, bar, for example, regulatory approvals, so all the signatories, documents were signed, then they put an effective date that said, subject to only conditions precedent being met after the event, then you would be okay. And we would suggest that something like that is appropriate for the February date. We're not suggesting that the budget date be moved. We are suggesting that if your transaction was done, but for example, Competition Commission, then that shouldn't prevent it. The second topic I'll just touch on is what is termed a value shifting arrangement. And here, again, the issue is it's a very technical, funny little one in terms of deferred tax. But broadly, if a husband and wife contribute a business into a company for reasons of ring fencing or creditor protection, etc., that can be done in terms of the Tax Act on a tax-neutral basis. Their base cost and the assets goes into the company. They have an equivalent at the share level. But there is an anti-avoidance measure that says, if the value of the shares differs from the value of the assets transferred, then that difference can be either capital gain or subject to dividends tax, depending on whether the value is greater or lower. The oddity in this regard is that if I own an asset worth 100 on a base cost of 20, I transfer it to the company. The company now has that asset, but it's taken on the deferred tax in that if the company disposes of it, it will pay tax. Because of that, the shares that I hold aren't worth the same 100.
You're left with 2 minutes.
Thank you.
2 minutes.
Perfect, thank you. The shares that I hold aren't worth the 100. They're somewhat less than that. The proposal by Treasury was aimed at addressing that this year, but is limited to where the deferred tax is recognised in terms of IFRS, the accounting standards, but that won't always be the case, so our proposal there is that the reference to IFRS be dropped. Finally, the other one I'll touch on is, again, interaction of anti-avoidance provisions. If you do a transaction within a group of companies, basically it defers the tax until a later point in time. What we've identified is there's an instance where you both get hit with a degrouping charge, where the transferor and transferee get split apart, and then on top of that you also get hit if there's a related loan that gets repaid, you're deemed to have a base cost of nil on it. The example that we've given here is that for rolling over a gain of 80 Rand, you actually get taxed on 180 Rand of gains in down the line. Chair, I'll just get 2 seconds on the last one. There was a final proposal on withholding taxes that you need to do a form, but the SARS form needs to be renewed every 2 years. We're totally against this. We see this as an unnecessary administrative burden. SARS's own forms at the moment to do this require taxpayers to give an open-ended undertaking to advise if circumstances change, and we believe that is adequate in its own right. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Transaction Solutions. 12 Cape. Is 12 Cape here? Okay, you have got 10 minutes.
Can I start?
Yes, you can start. 10 minutes, allocated time.
Good morning, honourable ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for having us. By way of introduction, my name is Chris, and my partner next to me is Ihu. We've created 12 Cape, a Section 12J hospitality fund in line with both the spirit and the letter of the law. We're a SARS-approved, FSCA-regulated, a public company, externally administrated, and audited by PwC. 12 Cape is a pooled fund. It's managed by professionals with an express focus on creating hotel keeping capacity in Cape Town. We're proudly local in our procurement and uncompromising in our vision of creating a world-class service for our foreign guests. If you can go to the next slide. So in the 10 minutes we allocated to us, we'll demonstrate the efficiency of Section 12J as a mechanism which keeps savings in South Africa, as mentioned before. This puts South Africa in a position to share in the growth of global tourism, and which fairly shares the foreign capital injection between the fiscus, labour, and owners of capital. We've tried to keep it as simple as possible, as requested by the Honourable Chair earlier on. Let's go to the next slide, Ihu. You see two charts on this slide. If we zoom out for a second, as these charts demonstrate, tourism is a booming business globally and outpaces global GDP by some margin. Last year, tourism was not only the largest but the fastest growing sector globally and employed 1 in every 10 people on the planet. In times of a weak rand, a hard currency and externally funded sources of labour-intensive growth is scarce. This opportunity is available on our doorstep, and this is a structural trend which will continue for decades, driven by long-term growth in global ageing, in the experience economy, in the middle classes of the emerging markets, and advances in technology. go to the next slide. South Africa deserves to be a part of it. As a country, we're well placed to share in this healthy, foreign-funded flow. The natural beauty, diverse nature of our position on the European timeline, with its 500 million plus market, is a permanent competitive advantage. The base is very low. As a country, we get a fraction of the tourism receipts that some European cities receive. As a labor-intensive industry, it provides an attractive and externally funded solution to our unemployment challenges. Global demand is in place, and if we didn't have structural issues on the supply side, tourism could very easily double in South Africa based on global demand only over the next 7 to 10 years. On the supply side, our president has recognized this opportunity and has called it the new gold. Our government's objective is to double tourism, with its commitment shown in visa relaxations, in crime and destination marketing. For tourism to double, tourism accommodation must double. In Cape Town alone, we require 30,000 rooms over the next 7 years. There is currently 7,000 being built or in the pipeline to be built. Capacity creation is crucial and it is essential. Let's go to the next slide, please. So we invest in hotel keeping capacity, specifically to create this capacity. If we use the qualifying company limit as an example, for every 50 million rand we raise from retail investors, we can create hotel keeping capacity of 16 rooms furnished with proudly locally made furniture and art and branding. The investment will give us the ability to host 4,380 tourists over the investment period of 5 years, assuming an 80% occupancy rate, which we think is achievable. Go to the next slide. So over the 5 year period, our 4,380 foreign guests will bring and inject over 50 million rand of their foreign currency in our economy. That is based on a 1,200 rand rack rate, which we believe is conservative given the global trends. The foreign currency injection in our economy is more than our original investment amount and is made up of 50% of accommodation and 50% on spending outside the hotel. The potential tax earned on this revenue over the period amounts to 16 million rand and represents a new and growing foreign-funded and labor-intensive income stream for the fiscus. Dividend and capital gains at the sale amount adds a further 10 million rand plus to the fiscus. Hence, total potential tax revenues of 50% of the 50 million rand original investment, of which 60% is foreign funded. In summary, the maximum tax benefit, inclusive of a CGT recoupment, could be anywhere between 0 and 27%. It catalyzes tax revenues of 50%, of which 60% is foreign funded, and catalyzes foreign direct investment of 100%. We go to the next slide on job creation. Talk about job creation for 1 second. Tourism is obviously a very labor-intensive industry. Wesco tells us that for every 12 tourists, one job is created. Let's sense check that for a second. 12 foreign tourists will spend 19,200 rand per day. To keep 12 foreign tourists occupied, happy and fed for a day will require way more than one employee. So I think this 12 number is very conservative. If we stick to the 12 number, however, our 4,380 tourists will create 365 job years, i.e. years of employment for one person. The building element creates another 400 once-off job years, or an average of 160 jobs per year over the 5 years. If we go to the final slide for me, Michu.
Please round up, you are left with 2 minutes.
Okay, this is a win-win for government. For every 50 million in Rand investment invested by our investors, government contributes between 0 and 27%, take the average 13.5. In return for that, get 100% of FDI, tax revenues of 50%, and 800 job years, of which 365 could be permanent. I'm going to hand over to my colleague Ihu to summarize.
Yeah, in conclusion, we believe 12J hospitality funds like 12 Cape will be very effective in keeping investor money in South Africa, promoting tourism, job creation, and attracting foreign currency. We believe 12J hospitality funding is essential if we want to create tourism infrastructure to share in the growing global tourism pie. The cost of managing these funds is however high, and as the 12J Association pointed out earlier, the proposed cap of 2.5 million will result in a minimum requirement of at least 100 investors to achieve this sustainable size of a 12J company. We ask, though, therefore, that any changes to Section 12J is in favour of a stable regulatory framework which will position our fiscus to reap the long-term benefits of an investment in tourism and in the hospitality industry. Thank you very much.
Thanks, 12 Cape. Banking Association of South Africa. 10 minutes.
Honourable Karim and members, my name is Ian Clutie and my colleague Kirshni Naika. Together we lead the Banking Association Indirect Tax Committee. It's the first time that we've deemed it necessary to take the extreme measure of coming to this forum to present an issue. We're here to talk about Section 72, but by definition it affects the entire VAT regime in our view. And if I can just won't get stuck there. Section 72 is a discretionary section. It gives the Commissioner the power to overcome anomalies and difficulties in interpreting issues in the section. I drew the analogy the other day that it's like water, that you need to dissolve a little bit of salt or mud in a cock where you can't achieve what you need to achieve. You need to add a drop or two of this liquid, and that solves the issue to get the intended outcome of what you're trying to achieve from the legislation. Combined, the proposed changes that National Treasury and SARS have put forward basically take the wetness out of that water. It takes the discretion out of the discretionary section, leaving it useless and powerless. And not as a banking industry, but as South Africans in general, we think that it's a very important part of that design in general, not just in South Africa, but internationally. So with that in mind, perhaps we can just go and look at what Section 72 does seek to achieve. It's a mechanism to overcome difficulties, anomalies, and incongruities in the application of provisions in the Act. And it's therefore for any vendor or class of vendors or people or parties that transact with that vendor or class of vendors. So it's not just for registered parties. And it's achieved by the Commissioner using his discretion to make an arrangement or decision on how to apply a section in the Act or how to calculate tax or apply the zero rate or an exemption. So effectively, as long as the ultimate tax liability is substantially the same, the Commissioner has the right to tweak things. Now, we understand that the Commissioner and National Treasury are under huge pressure because of some abuse. This discretion has been taken too far. We read between the lines, and what's now happened is that we we're amputating a hand instead of fixing the problem. So we feel that if one looks at the changes that have been proposed, just some of them, the first one is the commissioners, or the change says that where, unless there's a whole class or more than one party with a problem, the commissioner's hands are tied. He cannot change something if there's a unique problem applicable to a unique vendor or party transacting with a vendor. Now, if we think of the telecommunications, let's not think of Telkom, Transnet, the Parastatals, Eskom, if they came up with a problem that was unique, the commissioner wouldn't be able to use 72 to overcome it. If we look at the deleting of the reference to zero rating or exemption, we're not quite sure what that is intended to achieve. Perhaps the decision is strong enough to cover those aspects, but we worry that it's not so, that there's still some uncertainty that the commissioner won't be able to use the zero rate where the tax effect would have been neutral anyway to overcome a problem. We've recently had, in the last number of years, a couple of rulings where the commissioner has ruled that 72 be used to zero rate, for instance, where there was uncertainty about the price of brown bread, where the historic definition that was used was very rigid, and it was clearly out of line with practice. And the commissioner made the pragmatic ruling in terms of 72 to solve that while the legislation catches up. Then also by deleting substantially and ultimate, we're really concerned that just by ruling or not ruling will already change the total VAT take. So if the commission is unable to rule because the ultimate tax may be very slightly different, we feel that the section also becomes completely toothless and superfluous in that regard. Then, if I can page to the next one, there we go. I'm going to save the committee some time here, and we've got another example, but effectively we beg that the committee consider alternative mechanisms to ensure that the abuse that has led to these drastic changes are curbed or managed, and one of those, I think, Treasury or SARS have come up with themselves, and that was that that perhaps these rulings be published, and that automatically opens it up to public scrutiny and allows people to comment on things that might be detrimental. I have another example just to help people understand the kind of situation where a 72 would be used or could be used. Assume that you have a South African company that is very keen to tender for a project in, let's say, Namibia. In order for them to do so, the Namibian government insists that they register a company in Namibia and that they charge VAT on their services in that country. So they establish a subsidiary, and then the South African company charges or renders the services to the subsidiary who on supplies it to the ultimate clients. However, because all the work is actually done in South Africa, management and control is done here, there's a technical issue. The income tax definition of resident isn't complied with. From an income tax perspective, that Namibian entity is taxed in South Africa, and the VAT Act follows suit. And therefore, all of a sudden, the suppliers from the South African entity to the Namibian subsidiary cannot be zerated, which means that you would end up with double tax. So you'll be raising VAT in South Africa and Namibia on the same services. The obvious cascading effect means that company will simply not be able to tender for that project, and desperately needed foreign currency will not be entering South Africa. Now, it's true that one can fix this in the legislation in the next round of events, but this tender is just open for 3 months or for six, and by that time there is no ways that the legislative process can solve for the issue, and therefore that foreign currency potential is not realized in South Africa. That's just one of many, many instances where really the ultimate net income tax and tax liability would have been exactly the same, but that cannot be addressed because if these measures are implemented, the Commissioner's hands will be tied. And we just beg that there must be other mechanisms, Honourable Karim, to police or to manage the use of this section. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Banking Association. SA Venture Capital Association. Ten minutes strictly for presentation.
Honourable Chairs, Honourable Members, thank you very much. My name is Shelley and I'm here for the South African Venture Capital and Private Equity Association. Just to start off with, we don't really look at Section 12J as an asset class specifically. We look at it as an income tax clause in the Income Tax Act, which essentially enables fund managers to raise funds into underlying companies. So why is venture capital key for growth? On the slide in front of you is effectively the 10 biggest companies worldwide as of 2019 by market capitalization. All of those highlighted in orange received venture capital funding at some point in their growth phases. And I think that's just key to be able to show that actually, really as an economy like ours, although these are, you know, all over the world, we really can't afford not to be investing in this asset class. From a SAFCA perspective, we've looked at the types of investments and really as that's increased over the amount of years. So that really shows that actually obviously you have the financial crisis that hit and they had a deterioration in investment and then it's taken off and it's really been assisted by the Section 12J incentive. This slide is really taken from the Finance Minister's policy paper that he sent out for public comment. And essentially I'd like to just highlight two aspects to it. We identify several cost-cutting interventions that would help lower barriers to entry across a number of sectors: competition policy and new regulation, development finance, venture capital, and patient capital, as well as government support. They then include something about the importance of high-growth firms. High-growth firms that contribute disproportionately large proportions of net employment growth. They also contribute disproportionately to innovation and productivity growth. And this is essentially where venture capital invests. And without that venture capital investment, it really can't thrive. So I think what I'd like to highlight here is the fact that the Finance Minister is looking at this and saying that we need more investment here. Really what we're saying is Section 12J has allowed investment to happen in this space, and really we just need to keep on with it and make sure that it can prove its worth. Section 12J and early stage investment. VC funds were previously unable to raise viable funds without the added benefit of the 12J incentive. We believe that this is significant and the success of the government intervention should be highlighted. We wouldn't be here today if it actually wasn't successful. If we hadn't raised the amount of capital that we have, well, really this wouldn't be a debate that we would be needing to have. Why was it so important? Well, individual investors were unable to reconcile the risk profile of investing into SMMEs with really the return prospects. And what the incentive allowed was actually the ability for the government and private sector to work together to come up with a solution that can then crowd in investment into this space. It's really been highlighted before, but for us, the really important thing is policy certainty. Investors are committing capital for the long term. That's why they call it patient capital. They need policy certainty because it provides a significant role in investment decision-making process. The continual adjustments to the legislation creates an unstable policy environment and effectively a distrust towards actually where they want to invest their money. Our concerns with the TLAB proposal, I think that they've been highlighted with a couple of the other people that have spoken, but really fundamentally what we believe is we expect a reduction in the number of fund managers who are able to raise capital to invest into to SMEs in a sustainable manner. We spoke about a 200 million as what we believe a minimum amount is for a sustainable fund size. And really with a cap, that's at least 80 investors are required. That's a significant increase in operational capability and cost to administer. What we believe is actually you should be able to raise capital from high net worth or wherever you're able to raise capital for, but your focus should be on investing into the underlying companies and helping them grow. You don't want to spend all your time and your operational capacity just making sure that you can continue. If you need to remember that these VCCs themselves are SMEs, they're trying to manage all the different requirements that National Treasury and SARS have put on, as well as the FSCA, as well as make sure that they actually invest into the right types of companies that give the growth that we're so expecting. Also, most venture capital funds require anchor investors for traction, and they would definitely invest higher than 2.5 million. We've spoken about the connected person test, which is really just the retrospective application of this and the ability for VCCs to meet all the criteria. So really, what is SAFCA saying? Initially, our starting point was exactly the same as SAICA's perspective, was if you're concerned about abuse, tackle the abuse or where the actual funds are going. We don't think a cap is the right way to go about it, and really I think part of the point was is that it didn't succeed initially because there was a cap in the first place. By reintroducing it, you're really creating more problems. We do understand, though, that National Treasury is in a very difficult position in terms of the fiscus and effectively what the incentive has done in terms of this. So, with that in mind, we would like to suggest the following. If you're going to have a cap, increase it to 10 million, and then potentially introduce an accelerated allowance for the amount invested above the cap. So you can spread that over a number of years. And really what we're trying to say there is just give an alternative to what National Treasury has proposed with bearing in mind the restrictions to the tax base. What would that look like in principle? Sure, that's very small. So if you had to invest 5 million, you would get the 5 million up front, 8 million the same. But if you invest over and above the cap, you then have to split the balance over a number of years. And then effectively what it does is it still encourages people to invest in this asset class, but it will just spread the risk to the tax base. We looked at an alternative proposal, and really what that was to categorize the underlying types of investments within the qualifying companies to potentially create a cap per category. The categorization would need to be done on investment mandate of the fund or the class of shares, depending on the VCC, but it really would require National Treasury to refine and prioritize their objectives in relation to the incentive and the impact they are looking to create. This is likely to take quite a long time, so we're not suggesting that they do it necessarily now, but they've given themselves a sunset clause, so there's no reason that the work couldn't be done in anticipation of the June 2021 sunset clause. Thank you very much.
Thanks. As a venture capital association, British American Tobacco of South Africa.
Thank you, Honorable Chair.
10 minutes.
Yes. As you may be aware, BETSA is a member of TISA, so most of our positions would align on this issue with regards to a proposed excise freeze for at least a period of 3 years, until duty paid volumes can pick up to be able to compete against illicit products. But what I will do for this purpose, I will not cover the same ground that Francois covered earlier. What I will simply do is to just come up with specific interventions that we're proposing in terms of how you're going to make up the numbers in terms of ensuring that excise revenue collections are stable. But also, as Honorable Karim mentioned earlier on, we were here last year and we did cover some of the issues that also spoke to enforcement. And I'm glad that the official from Treasury, from SARS is present here to be able to also find out what happened to those proposals and what sort of interventions from a better point of view are proposing. I mean, recent findings and experience from our side indicate that excise rate increases will not result in further tax revenues. On that score, we agree with TISA wholeheartedly. I mean, some of the drivers of this is what we are seeing in the economy, a stretched consumer, that will continue to consume illicit products in the event that prices continue to increase. So technically, from the point that Treasury was making earlier on, that elasticity is really the real driver of declining revenue collections. Contrary to that perspective, really, consumers are not really quitting smoking. Instead, they are trading down to actually consume illicit products. So that is something that we wish this House should note for the purposes of our proposal. What we are also seeing is an excise framework, especially for the tobacco category, that is out of balance, and we propose that there could be opportunities for recovering revenue from other tobacco categories that are not currently covered. If we look at the negative economic climate in South Africa, that slide I will just put in just for demonstrative purposes. I will not go into that yet. This is to my introduction. So if we look at the negative economic climate, it results in unaffordability for the consumer, which results in them consuming illicit products. And illicit traders have taken advantage of this by manipulating market conditions and making sure that they can take benefit of this without Treasury also enjoying a necessary uplift of this opportunity. The latest increases at the bottom half of the cigarette market have shown that illicit traders have continued to make more benefits than the economy has. So in this regard, if we look at this slide, from 2014 to 2019, these are figures that are consistent with what we got from Treasury that show you a decline in what is the legal tobacco industry. And from 2020 onwards, those are our own figures that we've reworked. And what this clearly demonstrates is that you are seeing an ever-increasing presence of illicit trade that is continuously eroding into the legal space, and you are seeing very limited enforcement success to be able to actually capture these lost revenues back into the fiscus. So these are some of the opportunities that we think are missed opportunities where revenue should be collected by SARS. And we propose that something should be done in terms of addressing these weaknesses. Our findings also reveal that if you look in the last at least 5 years or so, you will see that overall, Treasury has significantly missed their targets in terms of what they focused as revenue collection, with the light blue showing you the focus and the dark blue showing you what was actually collected. And you will see an incremental rise in the light gray block that shows you what potentially could have been collected as revenue. And this is what we feel is a missed opportunity, that with an excise freeze that will allow us to be able to have the legal products to play in on an equal playing field, that could actually start to bring those figures within sync. And you will also see just above those blocks that we've showed you, you'll see what the excise incidence has been over the years. And in contrary to what Treasury mentioned earlier on, that they've tried as much as possible to stick to the excise incident targeting, it's actually been higher than what was the case, and that has not actually resulted in any positive yields. So what that does show you is that actually those two assumptions that were presented earlier on also are problematic, and it's something that for the benefit of an excise increase next year or a proposed freeze, these are considerations that should go into that in order for us to be able to stem the tide of illicit. Now what we are proposing from a balanced excise framework is based on the category itself. If you take the risk continuum model that says, you know, your tobacco products are the highest harmful of the risk continuum, you will see that the cigarette category has always been relied upon to be the carrier of revenue generation. Yet recent history, as I showed in the previous slide, proves otherwise, that actually that is not the case. In fact, you've been declining in terms of your revenue collections. There are other opportunities, actually, that can assist in ensuring the full revenue potential for Treasury. These are other tobacco products like your pipe tobacco, as well as your tobacco heated products. These offer a huge opportunity in terms of recovering some of the lost revenue opportunities. We propose that if you increase some of these categories, like, for example, pipe tobacco, which are equally harmful as the cigarette category, to at least to the same levels, you would be actually expanding the opportunities for collecting on revenue collection. In terms of our excise framework recommendation, therefore, we are proposing that we have a balanced fiscal and supported by administration framework. From a fiscal framework, we are proposing that in the short term, which we propose as a three-year period, to have an excise freeze on the cigarette category while increasing your excise on the other categories that are currently either under tax or not taxed at all. We feel that these categories like pipe tobacco as well as a new excise on tobacco would generate new revenue streams for the fiscus. After shifting the duty to non-paid, we feel that shifting duty non-paid consumption into paid consumption, we feel that this would create the space for the Treasury to start again imposing an excise that will be within its 40% incident targeting. From an enforcement point of view, we know that last year we did advance a number of solutions to the South African Revenue Service based on the outcomes of the research that Francois spoke to earlier on that came out of Ipsos. Around this, SARS had undertaken some new measures earlier in the year around production counters, which we commented on, and we feel that those are low-hanging fruit from which we could benefit. We could also benefit from raw material reconciliation that will allow for SARS to be able to account for domestic production and allow for fiscal payments. The visible payment, the visible enforcement in factories that we currently see could also be supported by more CCTV support, as well as ensuring that this is centralized and captured within a SARS database. Border controls are other mechanisms that could be used. Francois spoke earlier on to forensic capability. That is something that we are proposing could be looked into as an opportunity to be able to tighten on enforcement. We also feel that the current Customs and Excise Act is quite weak in terms of the punitive measures for those that transgress the law. We feel that there's an opportunity for the Customs and Excise Act to be re-looked at in terms of putting more stringent mechanisms for punishing those that avoid paying their taxes. As Honorable Karim pointed out correctly, whether you are regarded as a small or big taxpayer, what is important is that we all...
Hello?
Yes, sir.
You are left with 2 minutes.
Thank you. Whether you regard yourself as a small or big player, we all have an equal responsibility to pay that tax. And I would really, really wish us to seriously consider expanding the tax to other tobacco categories. It matters very little whether it contributes 10 rands or a billion. At the current moment where we are as a country, we need every penny that we can get from a tax point of view to be able to plug the hole so that we reduce the deficit that is predicted to be around 50 billion for the current collection period. That is our input. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson.
Thank you, BATSA. Now it's time for questions and responses. Questions, honourable members? Honourable Mavileza, Dr. George, A. Lewis, okay.
Start with you, but much as I appreciate the revenue and the tax that we receive, but my personal wish is to see everybody stop smoking and to not be having these problems of health. And I don't even want to go there and remind each other. It's just a comment. And then to... those that for tourism, what company is that? Yeah. In the slides here, you are talking about a very effective in promoting tourism, job creation, and foreign currency earnings, which our country desperately needs. We appreciate about the job creation. But I'm just wondering, how many are registered South Africans with ID, or how many are registered with real permit? I don't want to say a lot, because we can say jobs, jobs, jobs. How many do we have, our youth, who are registered, who are in those?
Okay.
Okay, thanks, Honorable Mavila. Honorable George.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the 12J issue, I think there seems to be consensus that encouraging venture capital is important for our economy, and that nobody is arguing that we shouldn't have a tax incentive to encourage it. We all know that our economy is in a very poor state, and that if we can encourage venture capitalists into it, we should do that, and we should provide tax incentives. SARS is clearly concerned about the abuse of this incentive. I remember when we were discussing this incentive, the principles of why we wanted it still are there. And at the time, we also discussed that it can be abused. So I think SARS needs to up its game in terms of preventing and addressing abuse, because I do think it is abused. I also see quite a lot of advertising for it, and it clearly is possibly a tax evasion scheme. I do think that the proposal of this 2.5 million cap is too low. I think it should be higher, and that it should be meaningful, because if it is too low, it is not going to do what we were hoping it would do. I also think we should consider that if there is money apparently lying around because there has been incentives on it but it hasn't been invested, there needs to be some intervention to make sure that that does not happen. So I think the problem lies in the implementation of this scheme rather than the users of the scheme. Then on the tobacco tax, I don't support ring-fenced taxes either. I do also support the individual rights of individuals to smoke if they want to, but I do support the current fairly heavy taxation on tobacco products. The illicit cigarette problem we know of, and we also know of all the other problems it caused by the unit that was attempting to resolve it, but that is a different issue. The problem of illicit cigarettes lies in enforcement, legal enforcement, by the relevant bodies. It does not lie in freezing the taxes on it as proposed. So I really do not have any sympathy for the tobacco industry in this regard. Thank you.
Hey, Louis.
I just wanted to address myself to the issue of the cap for Section 12J. I agree that it does seem, I take the point made by the various presenters that this is an industry that relies on scale for efficient management, and that at 2.5 million it would be very difficult to reach sufficient scale to make it worthwhile. So there was a proposal from the new association, and then there was a different proposal from 12 Cape, and another proposal from you, ma'am. Yes. So I'm just trying to, you know, get an idea of how we combine all of these proposals into something useful for our deliberations. And I wonder whether the association, as the official voice of the industry, should not send us, you know, go away and discuss among yourselves what you think could be more workable, and send us something in writing. It would be helpful to me.
We would be happy to do so.
Okay, thank you. SARS and Treasure, is there any study on the impact of the 12J incentive on job creation? Then can we respond to those of you who have to fill the questions that have been asked by members? Who will start? Oh, Treasure.
Okay, as you have previously said regarding the advert and the abuse of 12J, we have seen it. That is the structures that are there, the abuse. So the 12J is coming, there's a sunset clause in 2021. That's when we're going to do the actual review. But I just want to highlight to Parliament that the VCC regime was meant for investment in SMMEs because SMMEs were the ones that were having difficulties in getting finance. What you see here in Parliament is that the investment is in hotels. So I want to highlight that to Parliament that the main aim of VCC was that SMMEs are getting it difficult to get finance. So with regard to the amendments that we have made last year regarding the abuses, is the structures that we have seen and the adverts that we have seen regarding the abuse. So come 2021, when we're going to do the review, that's when we're going to send out a questionnaire and then we do a review whether to keep the incentive or to repeal the incentive.
Thanks. 12J.
Just 2 points. First of all, Honourable Hill Lewis, as mentioned, we're very happy to consolidate comments and bring that forward to you in written form following this. Maybe just two things from our perspective is, first of all, to point out once again that Treasury made extensive changes to certain structuring elements of 12J in the 2018 TLAB, which in our view is effective in clamping down on the abuse which we concede was taking place prior to October of 2018. And we again just wish to point out that the period of time from which those amendments took place, which if I recall correctly was the 23rd of October 2018 and now is very short, and as such the impact of those changes that Treasury have made is yet to fully have taken effect, but we believe them to be effective. Secondly, on the matter of hotels, it's an interesting thing. We, you know, we haven't put forward the research that Pricewaterhouse have been conducting for us, but you know, the question is, what do you want the incentive to do? As regards job creation, hotels are overwhelmingly one of the asset classes in South Africa that create the most permanent and sustainable jobs. So, you know, it is true that hotels are something that investors see as attractive to invest into, but it also is true that is a hugely effective job creator in South Africa in contrast to something like a tech company that does not create many sustainable and permanent jobs. And so, you know, just maybe to point that out as well. Thank you.
Thanks. Let's allow them to respond then.
I would just like to add as well, the small businesses that we invest in, although we have in hotels, what we do is all the furniture is going to be made locally here in Pardon Island. The young and upcoming artists that's going to create the artwork for us to put up against the wall, that's investing indirectly into those small businesses. There's no other way for me to directly invest in those businesses, but I'm doing it through the hotel business that we are building and creating, which will employ people directly into the hotel, but we're also supporting those small businesses that you're referring to, although it's indirect. And that's how we're making that investment through a 12J.
Okay. B.A.T.
Thank you very much, Chair. I realize that what we got as feedback were comments, and we take these on board. But what I would just like to plead with the honourable members on this is that in as much as there is some reality to the fact that we need both, you know, in our view at least, a balanced exercise framework coupled with enforcement. We know that enforcement, where we stand right now, it's an open secret that it's going to take some time for SARS to rebuild that capacity. And we all look forward to hearing what the officials from SARS have been doing since last year to actually enforce and make sure that they deal with the problem of illicit trade. But the one thing I would implore the members not to do is to send the wrong message. The message out there that while this is being sorted, that all the criminals can actually get away with impunity in not complying with tax. I would really, really want us to say that we are working collectively in this in trying to resolve this problem through whatever measures that we can that actually will make the industry compliant.
Tobago Institute.
Chair, thank you for allowing me. I think I just need to support my colleague, Johnny, what he said. And this is with greatest of respect, not about not having sympathy with the tobacco industry. This is what Honorable Karim said. This is all cigarettes and everybody must pay their tax. And that's what it's about. It's not about sympathy for the tobacco industry. If we live in a perfect world, nobody would smoke. But there's more than a billion people in the world who still smoke. There's more than 8 million adults in South Africa who smoke. So all we're asking for, and what Johnny said is absolutely true, let's not get the message wrong here. This is not about sympathy for the tobacco industry. This is about getting everybody paying their taxes and create a level playing field. SARS is doing good things. For example, the track and trace tender, which is out there now, let me inform the committee that if that is implemented in the European Union, it took 4 years in a sophisticated market to implement the track and trace system. SARS has put officials in factories, which was our recommendation. It had an initial impact, and at the moment it's flattened out. SARS confirmed to us a week or so ago there was an initial increase in taxes, but it flattened out. So that's why we make the offer for better training, forensics, support, so that the 35 billion sticks can be tax paid. It's not about sympathy for the tobacco industry. You can increase the excise again. The only thing that's going to happen is you're going to burden the legal industry. Consumers will switch more and more from those expensive products to cheaper products. We will solve no problem. And that is our respectful view, and I just wanted to support what my colleague also said. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, point made. 12 Cape or...
SAFCA, the Venture Capital and Private Equity Association. Thank you. Just to note why there's a couple of industry proposals around and why industry hasn't reached consensus. I think when the explanatory memorandum came out, the idea that industry went in was that the 2.5 million was because of abuse. So obviously your proposal, if you're trying to deal with abuse, is, well, deal with abuse if where there's abusive structures. Following the public engagement, which was only on Thursday, essentially when we pressed National Treasury, it came more down to a fiscus issue in terms of the upfront deduction. So obviously within the amount of time, industry hasn't been able to just speak amongst themselves to come up with a reasonable proposal. I have no doubt we'll be able to do it, and we'll definitely do it with the 12J Association. For me, the interesting part about the 12J incentive is it's effectively a public-private partnership. And really what it is that National Treasury develops what they think the incentive needs to look like and where you can invest your money. And really it's up to the private sector to be able to raise capital to invest into where National Treasury wants that money to go. If tourism is in there, it's because that was by design. And if venture capital is in there, that's by design. We have no problem if National Treasury want to change their mind in terms of where they want to go, but I guess June 2021 seems like a logical way to do that and not chop and change every single time we have a TLAB. On the deployment, just interestingly enough, from a pure venture capital perspective, what normally happens is you've got a 10-year fund, so you raise capital for 5 years, and essentially, so you invest for 5 years into the underlying companies, and then sell them off and realize the capital for the second 5 years. Actually, 12J is a lot quicker than you would find in a normal venture capital fund, and they've only got 3 years to actually deploy the money. So the disconnect between how much you've raised and how much you've actually invested is just an industry norm, because obviously you get the capital and you need to figure out which investments are the best ones that are going to give you the good returns, etc., and that takes time. You can't get the money all on day one and invest it on day two. It just doesn't work like that. And practically, that is actually quicker than we see in typical venture capital around the world. So it is a function of just the way that the market operates. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Follow-ups? Honorable Mavele, Honorable Hilo.
I appreciate the answer of saying hotel create jobs. Yes, that is the bottom line. We all know that. But my question is, how many registered South Africans in hospitalities and hotel? Just one, if you can pick up one hotel, just that one. That's what I want. It might not come today, but I think we should sit down here and appreciate you. We've got this number in this hotel. This is the number of South Africans, youth especially, and simple. But we know that, yes, they create jobs.
Thanks. Honourable Lewis.
I think there's two points that I find persuasive which I'd like to hear Treasury on. The first is that, or one point you don't need to respond to, the a hotel is also an SMME, because I think you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the definition of an SMME is all the way up to 200 million in annual turnover. I'm guessing that most guest houses and boutique hotels and even quite, you know, some big hotels don't do that kind of turnover. That's the first thing. The second thing, this is a persuasive point, and I'd like to hear your view on this, ma'am. When you start an experiment like this, you should at the very least commit to seeing the experiment through before you assess its impact and tweak it for the next round. And so you can have an iterative experiment process where eventually you get the perfect result, but that at least for the period of the experiment you should see it through and not chop and change in the middle of it. Can I just have your response to that?
Thank you. With regard to that, when we introduce the VCC, like any other tax provisions in the Income Tax Act, whenever we see the abuse, we announce it in the budget that this is the abuse. Last year, the abuse was about trading activities, and we addressed those abuses. And this year, it is about the cap, and as Chris has said, that it impacts on the whole issue of progressivity of the tax system. So last year, even if there is a cap, we will still need to make changes on the trading structures that were there. So now, last year we did the trading structures, this year we are doing the cap. So even though the legislation can have a sunset clause of up to 2021, that does not mean that when we see abusive structures, we must wait till 2021.
Sorry, Chair. Sorry, I had raised my hand.
Honourable Mkiv.
Yeah, I just wanted to say to the 12J Industry Association, it seems that they want to romanticize the hospitality industry. And we cannot do something like that. In fact, you should encourage your members to ensure that we diversify our investments. You cannot take money towards the same direction because that is not sustainable. We want to build a diverse economy to ensure stability and to ensure a long-term sustainability of our economy. So once you say and encourage, actually, a trajectory, let's say, focus on tourism industry, that's very wrong. And the second question is that there's a strong perception out there that the hospitality industry in the country employs cheap labor, predominantly non-South African. We want to deal with that because it poses a threat in the job creation, because you are unable to give us a feedback and account, especially that the honorable member is asking that question. It is informed by that particular belief. You need to account and give us statistics so that you don't talk the language that we speak as lawmakers. You know that we want to create jobs. You know that we want to alleviate poverty. You know that we want to grow the economy. But you say these things, but you don't give us evidence. So please, when we come back here in the next financial year, give us hard facts and say these are the investments we have made, these are the jobs that we have created, so that you don't come and tell us cut and paste here. We've been hearing this story. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. Responses? 12.
Thank you very much for those comments.
12J.
Yeah, so I just want to confirm that it is our responsibility to come back and give you those facts. We're asking for a bit of time to, as SAFCA pointed out, we just need a bit of time to deploy the money to get the facts in. I think a few key things just to mention is what we're really targeting here is foreign tourists coming here to spend foreign currency. They tend to spend six times more than South Africans would spend on tourism. If we can attract that foreign tourists to come here and they spend six times more, then we can have more money to pay the employees that we are attracting.
So the taxes on that will also be significantly more than the tax deductions you get up front. And that is what we're aiming to do, but you are correct. We will work with the LJ Association, and collectively we need to come and show you those facts and figures.
If I may also respond just on a few of the points, to reiterate 12 Cape's point, and I have mentioned this earlier, is that we are in the process of putting together this report that I think everybody needs and everybody should assess. The survey has been sent out to all members and completed. It's just being compiled and analyzed and put together by PwC. So hopefully in the next month we should have a starting point. And I would really like to extend the invitation to Parliament and National Treasury to work with them as the association as we start to interrogate and understand this information. As regards the 2.5 million and the concerns around abuse, just to make it absolutely clear, in my view, an investment is not abusive just because it is large. An investment is abusive because it's abusive. In fact, because if you're targeting an incentive that raises money from high net worth individuals, you would hope for it to be large, so that that money can in turn be invested into SMEs, which grow the economy, as opposed to taken offshore. And so I think we must just delineate a large investment from an abusive investment. As regards the concern and the question around hotels, just to make the point that, you know, the issue has been raised about around hotels, and there has been some form of focus on hotel keeping in the industry. It's a bit of a market thing. Investors invest where they see attractive investments, and a lot of investors have seen tourism in South Africa as a key trend. That being said, I don't think we should underestimate or underplay the fact that 12J has invested into many other asset classes: renewable energy, student accommodation, agriculture, education. There are schools that are being built through Section 12J. Students are being housed where in the past they had to catch public transport for hundreds of kilometers to be educated, where now facilities are being constructed that allow them a bed to stay in. There are tech startups, there's various industries. So I think once we've got that information that we can present and put forward to you the next time we engage, it will allow for a more productive discussion. Thank you.
Okay, yeah. I think those are the responses. Let me find out from SARS, because the tobacco industry is coming more often. To what extent is this problem of illicit tobacco trade affecting our economy? I know the N1, for instance, was alleged to be one of the routes that is used for tobacco smuggling. Can you address the concern that they are raising?
In fact,
so that we are not seen to be like we are taking side. We want this industry. We don't. Our personal sentiments is something else. Let's deal with the tax matters and the business that we are here from.
It just mentioned over more than last year, new initiatives have been implemented, as was mentioned. And I think the more appropriate feedback would be if the commissioner appears before the committee next time.
Sorry, Chair. I just wanted to say that what I'm hearing from the tobacco industry, they seem to be punching holes into the capacity of SARS to be able to arrest the problem. And it comes very clear from the presenter that there's total dissatisfaction and there's no improvement. Instead, illicit trading, insofar as the tobacco is concerned in the country, is growing, and nothing is being done to turn that around. Maybe it would be great if SARS can look into that matter and actually confirm or dispute, so that we know how to assist or where we can come in and assist if there's capacity that is required.
So you propose that you will come back to the committee with all the facts. I think we need to deal with this matter with facts and establish where is the problem, so that if there's one part of the industry that is complaining, and as Honorable Mkive alluded to, that the tobacco industry is pushing the ball back to the SARS court, you have to respond adequately with the facts and show as to what are the actions that are going to be taken to close those loopholes. Let's move to the last set of presentation, Kingston Capital.
Honourable Chairpersons, Honourable Members, ladies and gentlemen, I address you today as a fellow investor keenly interested in the future of South Africa. We believe that South Africa is ripe with talent and fertile ground for investment. Kingston is a venture capital firm and also an approved venture capital company in terms of Section 12J of the Income Tax Act. In our first fund, we invested into 10 businesses, one of which I'll share with you a little later just how much of an investment it has been for the fiscus. The businesses we have invested in have not only created and supported over 120 permanent jobs, but are addressing key points like financial inclusion, improving access to finance for SMEs, and last mile distribution to the base of the pyramid in the informal sector. Having secured a $10 million guarantee facility from USAID and supported by the United States government, Kingston launched a $30 million fund earlier this year. Section 12J has been critical in catalyzing a venture capital market in South Africa, and for this we are extremely grateful. Recognizing the importance of building a long-term sustainable venture capital industry, we as a fund manager have spent considerable time in the United States looking to connect and plug into the global VC ecosystem. As fruits of our work, we have garnered investment support from US-based investors, and we are pleased to share with this committee today that after securing two multi-million dollar investment commitments, we are in the process of revising our fund size to $100 million. This, ladies and gentlemen, would not have been possible without the 12J incentive. The reason for this is that our first three investors participated and were prepared to back us because of the incentive, all three of which were way in excess of the 2.5 million cap that you have heard proposed today. Section 12J has been instrumental in introducing a new asset class to South African investors, and by that I mean true venture capital. Section 12J on its own is not an asset class. What I'm talking to you today is about investors backing real, small, and medium-sized businesses that are bringing technology and innovation to the market and driving a digital economy. The National Development Plan and its objectives towards stimulating this economy is modeled off a healthy and a healthy small business economy. If we are to achieve a 90% contribution to the employment workforce through SMEs, we are a long way to go from the current 28%. Investment into SMEs are critical if we are to achieve this goal and create millions of jobs for South Africans. But why exactly are we here today, and what is the problem with the cap? Let me explain the mechanics of fundraising. The first few investors who buy into your fund are investors who buy into your vision and future plans. You always need one or two investors who typically invest way more than the average. This then allows you to bring on more additional investors. These few large investors are called anchor investors. Putting this cap in place will not only disallow further anchor investors, it means no new funds. You have heard from previous presentations this morning how economically unviable a cap as proposed will be. Funds will no longer be able to raise meaningful capital. What I want to share with you today is that this cap will not only limit local investment, it will also have a direct impact on foreign direct investment. Any cap is a bad idea. Why? Because of investment, investment, and investment. No matter how much the proposed cap is, it will directly impact investment. As a country, you all know we are on an investment drive. In fact, we're all well aware that just last week, President Ramaphosa revived calls for investment at the World Economic Africa meeting. And he said, to which I quote, "I call on all investors here today, particularly local investors, to be part of this new momentum." My role here today as an industry stakeholder is to request that we please have a policy aligned with the President's call for action. But let me not attempt to convince you myself. I'd like us to please play a recording from the inaugural South African Digital Economy Summit back in July this year. Thank you. Chairpersons, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, the President wishes for us to have a strong venture capital industry in South Africa. And as industry, we are committed to building this. Please, let's not undo the good work by putting a cap in place. The cap will have the undesired effect of precluding anchor investment, which is all too critical from a fundraising point of view. From our perspective, local investors are critical in helping us raise further direct investment from foreign international markets. This is because every international investor wants to know that the fund has local investment support. 12J is critical in introducing a new asset class, being venture capital, to an otherwise risk-averse local investor pool. When we combine 12J and foreign direct investment, we start to gather this new momentum that the President refers. Section 12J is an allowance, as is an investment by government into the SME sector. I just want to share with you an investment case, a case study around this. We asked for some facts, for some information. And one of our first investments that we made a 3.5 million rand investment into a company. It cost the fiscus a max of 1.5 million rand in lost revenue up front, not taking into account future dividends tax and the rest of that. Upfront investment was 1,575,000 rand. Within 2 years, the fiscus from this one company has collected 7.1 million rand. 7.1 million rand, representing a net gain of 5.5 million rand, or a 351% return. Ladies and gentlemen, honorable members, this tax incentive is an investment by government into the SME sector, and the returns far outweigh the upfront deduction. Yes, it's risky from an incentive point of view. Yes, it's progressive. But it's also a tool for government, a mechanism for government to show its appetite for risk and innovation. Honourable members, no one ever changed the world by taking a conservative approach. To solve this large-scale unemployment and move our economy forward to the extent we need it to, it is going to be because men and women like you are taking big, brave, bold steps forward. We recognize the concern with having a large upfront deduction and the impact the incentive has on a constrained tax base. And we propose the following. We propose that there be an accelerated allowance over a three-year basis. 60% upfront in year one, followed by 20% in year two, and a 20% in year three. Chairpersons, honorable members, We believe a cap of any sort is a terrible idea. We are committed to investing into South Africa. Our investors are committed to investing into South Africa. We are a great nation with enormous potential. Please assist us today in creating a framework that will best facilitate local investors to participate with international investors and investing into our SME ecosystem, driving a digitally inclusive economy and creating jobs for our much-deserved fellow South Africans. Thank you.
Whatever the views of the committee as a whole, which it will decide over the next few weeks. Next then is whoever you are. The chairperson has just gone out for a few minutes. He'll be back. That's BMW South Africa. Where are you?
Yep.
Yeah, go for it, please.
Just click OK. You just click OK on, if you can use that small. Okay, good afternoon, honourable members. My name's Ben Hofden. I work at BMW. I'm responsible for plant finance. And we're going to go through, or why we're here today, is to discuss the proposed change to Section 65 of the Customs and Excise Act, which is the ad valorem tax on automotive vehicles. So if you just bear with me, if I can just give you a bit of background before we get more into the detail, just to give you an understanding or some background behind the auto policy and what's in place. So if we start just looking at BMW South Africa, you can see our footprint is made up of a number of different, let's say, divisions. So the core, really, the plant, we've got about 3,000 associates working there. We're based in Roslyn, just north of Pretoria. And we're producing the X3 vehicle there for mainly the European market. Also, we have a sales company which employs about 300 associates. Affiliated with that is our financial services company, another 200 associates. But also what we have on top of that is an IT hub, which is the SAP Center of Competence doing development for other BMW group companies around the world. So they're developing and supporting, let's say, the new systems and software that's put in place in other plants like China and Mexico. So on top of that, we also have our dealer network and our suppliers with about 4,400 and 14,500 associates working there. So our direct footprint in South Africa is 23,400 direct jobs created by us. If we look at the indirect effect and the studies from econometrics, the indirect jobs created from the directs is roughly a ratio of 1 to 3. So about 70,000 indirect jobs are as a result of that. So if we look how this is possible, it works if the right systems are in place. And I think that's where the auto policy that government has implemented and put in place has been a huge success. So what that auto policy implemented in 1995, when sanctions were lifted on the country, they put the MIDP program in place with a specific structure that looked at, instead of producing a number of different models, and at that stage it was 42 for the local market, that if we wanted to grow automotive, we would have to export. So the structure they put in place is rather focus on producing one platform or one model, high volumes, and you can get the economy of scale. And that's what we've done at BMW. As you can see on the right, our X3 production, we run three shift, 24-hour production there. So what that's ensured is that internationally we can be competitive, so if the vehicles are exported. But in order to have this structure in place, the duty rebate mechanism exists. So on the one hand, you produce high volumes, you can be internationally competitive, you export, and the vehicles that you import, you use the rebates that you're generating on the one side in the plant to import the vehicles that you sell locally. So this structure has meant that our plant and our sales division, and obviously the financial services division associated with that, are quite inextricably linked through the whole process. So if we just look at our successes from when the auto started, we've had a number of different models, but what we've seen is a constant growth in the different objectives of what the auto policy is trying to achieve. So far, investment-wise, we've spent about $11 billion from 1995 to date, and we've seen significant new technologies coming into the plant. So things that weren't here previously, which increase also the quality, environmental improvements, and that has a huge effect on the skills and training and development of the associates working in the plant as well. If we look at our volume, we now at our max volume, the highest we've had, 77,000 units, and our local content for our X3 is the higher than it's been in any of the other previous models. As I mentioned on the skills and training, so even though we've moved into a higher level of technology, we haven't reduced jobs. We've actually increased jobs, and the jobs have become more higher skilled on that side. So really the MIDP and the APDP auto policy that's been put in place has been a huge success for us as BMW, but also for the industry. So as I mentioned just now, with the process, export is key for us. So sorry, you can't see too clearly on there, but 95% of our volume is exported to Europe. Only 5% is sold in South Africa. And that's because we need this export volume to get the economy of scale and to be competitive. So when I talk about competitive, what do I mean? So our competition as Plant Rosslyn is not Mercedes, it's not Audi, it's not the other automotive manufacturers. Our competition is the other BMW plants group-wide. So we're constantly fighting for model allocation and volume allocation. And whoever can do it the most cost-effectively is normally where the models are allocated. So just to give you an idea, I mentioned we produce about 77,000 units. We're right at the tip of Africa, but the other plants, our plant in the U.S. produces 450,000 units. Our plant in China, 600,000 units. And to compete with that is becoming more and more difficult. And new on the landscape as well is we've got countries like Mexico and Hungary and Eastern Europe who really have a low labor cost. So some are at the same labor cost to us and some are actually cheaper. So us being seen as a low-cost country is no longer the case with these new emerging countries starting automotive production. So what we do is we, with our holding company, try to bring transparency to them to say, when we do a business case, it financially makes sense to do it in South Africa. So we just show them what are the different cost drivers of going into a car. So if you look on the top, labor, we have got an advantage because, let's say, labor is cheaper. Now, this illustration is an example to a developed market. But where we've got the cost disadvantage is material costs. So where we've got local parts in South Africa and we've localized them, we're localizing 77,000 units versus a Chinese plant doing 400,000, 500,000 units. So that economy of scale effect we struggle to compete with. And also for the parts that we import, logistically it costs us a fortune to bring them in, produce the cars and export them out. And this is where government intervention with the auto policy and the free trade agreements is so important, because that allows us to be competitive internationally. So you can see the APDP and the free trade agreement impact ensures we have a business case that we can be internationally competitive. So the Section 65 proposed change is the ad valorem tax change, which is part of that APDP benefit that we earn. So for every car we produce, we generate a rebate, and that's worth the duty we save and this ad valorem impact. If the change is made on the ad valorem, from one day to the next, our export competitiveness reduces significantly. It just changes. So what that means for us as a plant is the life cycle normally for a vehicle is 7 years. So we invested and started production last year in the X3. If this change happens, over the majority of the life cycle, this suite of benefits that was in place when we made the investment changes. Now it reduces. So our export competitiveness will also go down. So if a plant elsewhere can produce it more cost effectively, the volume will be reallocated from us. And the biggest challenge also what we see is that the credibility of the auto policy currently is strong with our holding company. So they never want to take government incentives into account in business cases, but we can always assure them, look back at the history, MIDP, APDP, it's always been stable, it's always been credible, you can rely on it. But if this changes now, that credibility will be undermined significantly for future business cases. So if this change does happen, and as I mentioned, our export competitiveness reduces, we will unfortunately lose production volume. Future investments will be impacted, and that will have the negative effect on reduced local content. The employment will unfortunately go down, both direct and indirect, but also a big concern as well is the trade balance for the country. So with us being mainly exporters, that dynamic will change significantly. If we look on the local sales side, so the vehicles that we're importing, if the ad valorem tax is changed, all that will mean is that this tax will be passed on to the customer. That increases the sales price, and with our price elasticity calculations, this will reduce our sales of new vehicles in South Africa. And that will have a corresponding effect on both the sales and dealer networks, where employment will reduce. And we believe from our calculations that the fiscus will collect less money compared to the additional money that will be generated from the ad valorem change. So to give you an idea, depending on the value of a vehicle, about 30 to 40% of the value is made up of the various taxes and duties, and that will be lost with a reduced volume that we have. If I can also just draw your attention to the changes recently on the automotive and also ad valorem, that in 2018, the threshold...
You're at 9.5 minutes, eh?
The ad valorem increased 25% to 30%, so that did go up last year. And also under the current master plan that was approved and communicated by Minister Davies last year, the benefits have reduced from the current APDP to the new master plan in future, which impacts as well our export competitiveness. So just to close, if I can hand over to my colleague.
Chair and honourable members, me and my colleague here, who are executive directors of BMW South Africa, we are here to plead with you, because this is a very complex industry where I believe government has demonstrated that together with the private sector, it can really build an industry from nothing and make it something that other markets in the world envies. We have an infrastructure here that other developing economies, they can never achieve if they start doing something today. What we are saying is that let's not pick and choose the things that we are trying to fix. We need to fix this thing as a total package, as we've been doing over the past decades. We have currently agreed a master plan that will take us to 2035. We are really pleading with government to say we have a structure together with DTI and Treasury where we've been negotiating this master plan. We would like to take anything that has to do with automotive industry into that structure so that we can debate things, so that whatever we change, we are absolutely sure that it does not impact on other things that can take us backwards. We need to fight for the position that we have earned over the world in this automotive industry. Let's not give it away to competitors like Morocco, who are really trying to get where we are.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, of course we are also acutely aware of the importance of the industry, but we have to move on. Who's next now? It's Busa. Where are you? Ah, yes.
No problem. Thank you, honourable members. Thank you for the time. My name is Sharmini Harrington. I'm representing Business Unity South Africa. For those of you who don't know us, we are a confederation of business organizations, including commerce, industry, professional associations, corporate associations, and unisectoral organizations. Our aim is to ensure that business plays a constructive role in the country's economic growth, development and transformation, and to create an environment in which businesses of all sizes and in all sectors can thrive, expand, and be competitive. The scope of our presentation here today is not to cover areas covered by others, but really to highlight the key issues, and I'm going to focus on the Carbon Tax Act and the amendments related to this. And as has been raised by the Chair, Honourable Karim, we have had a number of discussions on this issue over the past year and a half, if not longer. However, it is concerning to us that a number of areas that we had agreed through the parliamentary process would be reviewed or addressed through the draft rules and subordinate legislation has not in fact materialized, and we have some challenges. Having said that, there are some positive moves in terms of the amendments that we have seen here today, particularly the amendment of 12L, which we see an extension of the energy efficiency rebate. We do welcome this, and we would request that a proposal regarding the date be looked at to extend this even further, taking into account the long lead times for energy efficiency projects from business. In terms of the repeal of Section 12K, this we do not support, as the idea of a double benefit here is not necessarily true in all circumstances. We have provided a review or we have provided some proposals in terms of this, and we request the committee to look at a review of these. We have had consultations with National Treasury, and there is movement in terms of them reviewing these proposals as well, and we'd request the committee to also look at this in light of that from National Treasury. In terms of the Draft Tax Administration Laws Amendment Bill, while it is agreed that these amendments might be required, we are unsure of what they would actually mean without having seen the subordinate legislation. So this is a request to exchange information between the Department of Minerals and Energy, between SARS, as well as the Department of Environment, Forestry and Fisheries. Until we see the subordinate legislation, we're not sure how this would manifest and what the implications are for business. So we'd request here that until we see the subordinate legislation, we hold off on these amendments. I'd like to spend some time on the Draft Taxation Laws Amendment Bill. Here, as I've said, there's a number of concerns in terms of agreements raised here at Parliament, and assurances were given by SARS in terms of how this would be addressed in terms of the draft rules. We have seen the draft rules, and a number of the areas we agreed to have not, in fact, been addressed. And whilst there is a way forward, we do have workshops scheduled. We are doing this on the basis of not seeing the subordinate legislation. So here we are talking about the offsets regulations, the trade exposure, the Z factor, all of which we have not seen as yet. This becomes problematic in terms of policy certainty and has been raised by a number of other members here. We do have challenges in terms of how the Act is going to be implemented and the policy certainty that we need as business. We would also like to raise the concern that in terms of the amendments that are put forward, we feel this exacerbates the problems that we have already. A good example here is the amendment to Section 4 of the Carbon Tax Act, where there's a requirement for there's a requirement for how greenhouse gas reporting would be addressed through the Carbon Tax Act. Our view is that the lead department is the Department of Environment, Forestry and Fisheries, and this should not be done through the Carbon Tax Act and should not be done through National Treasury. We have a particular concern with the way these proposals are being put forward. We've asked for a meeting with all of the departments, relevant departments, to take this forward, and until this is had, we would like the amendments to be again reassessed on the basis of us providing a supplementary submission. Overall, we would request that, given what I've raised here today, that we review and consider a proposal to defer the date of implementation of the carbon tax based on the fact that a number of areas have not been addressed, and the fact that we would like to have a workshop to discuss how some of these amendments will be taken forward and the implications thereof. Thank you for that.
Well, you're a certain very powerful person from National Treasury. I think she's worse than Ismail Momon yet. Has been shaking her head and rolling her eyes and being very dismissive. So you think Momo's bad? Anyway, so over to the Tax Practitioners Association Institute.
Good day, honorable members, colleagues. My name is Beatrice. I'm here on behalf of the South African Institute of Tax Professionals. I see some of my former colleagues in front of me. Well, amicable party. Is it? Thank you, Honourable Karim. I would like to go through a couple of points. I'm not going to belabor points that were dealt with previously by some of my other colleagues. Just to quickly go through some of them, business tax incentives on the special economic zones. We understand the focus on greenfields. We understand the concern about dead weight and relocation. We're just feeling concerned about the fact that the 100% growth that is required in income in year one is too broad. Moreover, if you look at just general business, it's incredibly hard to achieve. So we are recommending potentially a pre-approval by DTI, so that can allow a principle-based approach as opposed to a rule-based approach, which will not give the kind of certainty that business needs in order to okay a certain type of investment. Then, there we go. So in
the anti-avoidance rule for 20% of connected person activity, when we look at SEZs again, in order to invest in an SEZ, you need a lot of internal business moving inside the country just in order to make it viable. So if we look at supply chain control that and supply chain management that needs to happen, a lot of times you will have an effect of exceeding to the 20%. So in this particular case, we would rather ask that Treasury perhaps focus more on a transfer pricing type approach, look at market value, as opposed to have a rule-based approach, which will exclude a lot of the kind of viability currently of the investment into SEZs. On the international tax side, I'm going to jump through those because I'm mindful of time. The first one was already dealt with by previous colleagues. If we look at international tax, the definition of permanent establishment also just a refocus in terms of looking at the entire OECD model, specifically the commentary surrounding it, so that it is more aligned with international tax there, as opposed to just having a South African-only approach as recommended. When we look at the change to the high tax CFC exemption, sorry, I just went one back. There we go. We're currently only focusing on the current rate of the UK, but we all know even though Brexit is coming or going or stalling, not exactly sure where it is at the moment, at least they're going to 18% and in all probability 17% quite shortly. So we would recommend at least having a look at where that is going forward. Otherwise, we're not going to be competitive. Then in terms of business transactions and finance tax, I know that there's been a lot of discussion in terms of dividend stripping. From our point of view, our view is just it will have the current proposal will have a significant effect on benign structures, including BEE share acquisitions. There's a lot of variables that actually needs to be taken into consideration. So we would ask that at least look at more at an effective and substantial change in ownership. I've seen that there's a lot of different other proposals. We request that Treasury just perhaps relook at this particular proposal and see what would be a more targeted approach. When we look at the impact of rollover provisions is particularly important in a country such as ours for inward investment, for people to invest, to move between companies, etc., to allow investment to flow. And there's been, over the last number of years, quite a lot of movement in rollover provisions. What that does is it makes it incredibly difficult to implement. It is hard to understand, and it becomes disjointed. So we would ask, rather than piecemeal approach, rather do a relook and look at the holistic structure of it as opposed to what is currently being proposed. In terms of value-added tax, I know a lot of what was said in terms of Section 72. The one comment that I think we can make, perhaps, that will take it a bit forward is that when we look at the concerns around Section 72, is that certain rulings are granted to a particular group of individuals who then enjoy a benefit even though it is published. But if there is a mechanism in the legislation to take this forward to say there has to be a review function built into every Section 72 ruling so that it can be taken up into legislation at some point or devolved, that will then strengthen the position with regards to keeping the economy going, which I know was discussed by BASA, but as at the same time allowing National Treasury and SARS a mechanism to get these things into law, which I think is one of the biggest issues that we currently face with regards to Section 72, that it's not a one-size-fits-all issue. I'm going to move on that. I know this is something that the committee has seen, and it is not something that's in the current legislation. However, when we look at the foreign employment tax exemption, I know that our sister organization, SAICA, has also dealt with this. There's been a lot of movement, and I know that there's been a lot written in the papers about this particular exemption and the changes to it. It comes in on 1 March 2020. So what have we seen thus far? We've seen that there's been an exponential increase in tax practitioners requiring support in trying to deal with their clients wanting to see South African tax residency on the one end, and those who have potentially ceased to try to regularize what they've done in the past. We also see a significant interest in moving assets abroad. Now, that sounds like fear-mongering. Is that true? Is that not true? We've seen a lot of information around that coming through from our members, so we can tell you that much. When it comes to multinational groups, we've tried to take on a hands-on approach. So they've expressed this concern at various forums as to how this will impact them, because in order to get South African tax residents, and actually most nationals, to go work in a different country, you need to support them from a tax point of view so that they are not paying more tax in that country than they would pay in South Africa. You also need to give them the same kind of standard of living type of allowance. And what that translates to in South Africa is that the payment that these people get in terms of fringe benefits, just to give them an equal basis, is quite significantly more than they would have had on a net cash basis had they stayed in South Africa. So we've asked companies, and this is perhaps the interesting thing for the committee, we and also National Treasury and SARS, I have set up a survey at the behest of our corporate members to try to draw out how is this going to affect them. So the intention with the survey is to see what is the effect of the amendment on companies employing South African tax residents employees that render services abroad, which is quite a significant number. The readiness of the affected companies to meet the challenges posed and the expected behavioral changes, which I think is of particular importance, that is due to the effect of this amendment. The final date for our submission is 27 September, and as soon as we've got the data and the analysis ready, we will of course make it available to the committee. I think in particular what the committee needs to be aware of is there's grave concern, and a lot of things have been set in motion which will need fairly quick reassurance or alternative movement to get it to halt. One of the things I think recommended, it's not particularly on the slide, but when this was proposed in the budget initially, the proposal said, it's proposed that this exemption be adjusted so that foreign employment income will only be exempt from tax if it is indeed subject to tax in the foreign country. Now, that particular sentence comes out of the budget Annex C 2017. What we have currently and the practical issues is a far cry from what we started with. I'm also aware that from payroll authors, I'm also a member of the payroll authors group, when I look at what they are currently doing, what I'm looking at when I talk to BASA, BUSA, etc., SAICA, there is not a company that I've spoken to that's ready. Not one. And irrespective of how many people are exiting the country as a result of this, and my colleague on my right mentioned the number of misinformation that's currently in the country around this, it's highly concerning. However, it is a complex issue, and a little information goes a long way when it is couched with be afraid, be very afraid. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Before I hand over to the chairperson, perhaps I should just draw attention, especially those of you who've been coming here repeatedly. Firstly, this is a Section 75 bill, and therefore most of the work, unlike with the 76 bill, gets done on the NA side. So I notice your constant reference to me, but please understand, democracy means internal democracy and so on, that you serve your term and then it's over. There's no traditional leader here or chairperson for life. So really you should be addressing your issues to the Standing Committee on Finance chairperson and the Standing Committee on Finance as it's constituted since the May 9th elections. Now, the second point I need to draw to your attention is our role here as the NCOP is more to observe. And strictly speaking, this is not a joint sitting. It's a Standing Committee on Finance sitting with the presence of the Select Committee on Finance. The third thing I need to draw to your attention is that the rules and the process we adopted between 2014 and 2019 was specific to that term. There's nothing in the Constitution or the rules of Parliament that dictate what we did. You will recall, for those of you who were here before 2014 making submissions, it was different, very different. It doesn't mean that the 2014 to 2019 term was better than the previous terms. That was just the dynamics at the time. The new committee will not necessarily do what the committee did previously, because there's no rule that requires this thing of you making submissions, then National Treasury coming back, then you being allowed to speak, then National Treasury. That was only introduced by us. So it's the new committee that will decide its own processes, as long as it abides by the constitutional and legislative and rule requirements of Parliament on public consultation. So please, you can't rush to any court or anything. You'll lose. There is nothing in the Constitution that says that what the Committee on Finance did between 2014 and 2019 is sacrosanct. There's no such thing. In fact, that was very unusual. And quite frankly, I'm playing a different role now because some of you have been reaching out to me, and I want to make it clear to you, there's no chairperson for life, you know, and I have many weaknesses, if a few strengths. So you've got a better committee now than you had then, and you've got a very experienced chairperson. So please, can you stop lobbying me on Section 75 bills? Your responsibility is to work with the Standing Committee on Finance. I hope Dennis Day is listening to me. Maybe we should make this Alan Comrade Chair sittings like this, Standing Committee on Finance, with the presence of, so to avoid that situation. Secondly, on the NCOP side, where's Dennis? Oh, he's even gone. Okay, there's nobody here from the opposition. All right, fine. I'll explain to him that I have to chair today at times only because there were certain exigencies, and it will not happen again. I will confer with the chair and the rules, the legal services unit. So over then to Comrade to yourself. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson, Honorable Karim. Let's take questions and responses. Honorable members, you want to ask a question?
Yes, am I allowed to make a comment?
Wait a bit. You had your share of comments. You are from 12J.
Yes.
Aye, 12J. You have you had the first.
I can turn it into a question if you'd like.
Let me first allow members to ask questions.
Thank you.
I have a comment, Chair.
Honorable Mkiv.
No, my comment, Chair, is I think I like the spirit with which the gentleman from Kingston Investment was speaking here, that they have a commitment to invest in the country. I think we must appreciate that. But one point that I would like to emphasize to him and everybody else in the House who represents business and business formation is that we are a country that is predominantly rural. And to some of us, that is a blessing. And the history of the country is that investments are highly concentrated in this country, mainly in three provinces. Would like to appeal to you that going forward, in order for us to have a game changer in the economy, you need to ensure that there's a geographic spread in terms of where money goes in the country. The urbanization that you see happening is sporadic and it's not planned. And partly it is influenced by the fact that you continue to put money where the apartheid regime concentrated money. Maybe you are doing that by omission. So we want to make that appeal that go to the rural communities and invest. In fact, I think it should be the way forward for you because it's becoming a saturation to invest in the cities because there's a lack of space and there's a battle for survival. So over and above that we say you must go to the rural communities and consider all the nine provinces because we are a unitary state. We want to see economic activity in all these provinces. Then lastly, the founding father of this democracy did something great by pulling the hands of the corporate sector and investors to embark on a social investment drive. And we have seen a lull insofar as that is concerned after he left office and so on. So I want to appeal to you that that social investment program actually makes a huge difference. I know it's soft power, it's not a lot of money, but it makes a huge difference when you do that voluntarily. Do it voluntarily. And maybe we will have a better hearing, because what I hear from you is that you want tax breaks. Nobody seems to like to pay tax, both individuals and companies. This is what I'm getting here. So, but we could be able to consider some of these matters. The complaints that you have about the caps and so on and so forth. But voluntarily demonstrate the love of this country, demonstrate that commitment that you say you have in terms of investing by putting millions, if not billions, into social corporate social investment. Really love that, and it would make a huge difference. We are more of a social democracy in South Africa. We're a welfare state, so to say. We are not apologetic that we are biased to the poor, to the working class. And half of the population, therefore, is concentrated in these rural and peri-urban areas. If you were to put serious money in that direction, we really appreciate. And we can really talk business if you do that. Thank you. Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Kim. Is there any comment or question? Okay. Treasury and SARS, do you want to make any comment and before we close?
We have no comments, but I want to say to Busa that regarding carbon tax, a meeting has been set to clarify some of the issues. But there are fundamental issues, like, for example, Section 4, whereby in terms of the money bill must have the base, the rate. So those issues are fundamental as to the making of the money bill. But that said, Charlene, a meeting has been set. And then I think during the workshops last week, it was clarified what type of information can be shared because between DIA and... Because what happens is that DIA can say, this is what you have. But if SARS now wants to ask more questions from DI, it will be difficult to read out that MOU. But that will be shared during the meeting. Thank you. And Chris.
Thank you, Yanga. Also, just we're working on the regulations. We'll try and get them out as soon as possible. I do also want to mention that some of the other vehicle manufacturers will be coming next week. So, but we are, as Treasury, setting up meetings with the vehicle manufacturers to discuss the ad valorem proposal. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I see you are raising your hand. Do you want to ask a question?
No, I just wanted to make a comment of Honorable Olani's question about investing across geographical, across South Africa. To say one of the things that we see tremendous scope and opportunity is in the informal sector, and bridging that divide between the formal and informal sector. We've made investments into that space and we'll continue to look into that space.
Okay, thanks. Hello, sir.
Good afternoon. Just on behalf of some of the automotive component manufacturers, bear in mind that the APDP incentive, the production incentive that is received by component manufacturers, is based on the sale of the rebate certificates to vehicle importers. With an increase in the ad valorem duty, the importers will immediately reduce the benefit paid on the PRCC values. So indirectly, any additional cost is going to come directly out of the pockets of the component manufacturers. That money that the component manufacturers normally receive on the sale of the PRCCs is both VAT-able as well as income taxable. So we are it's unfortunately having an indirect effect that the component manufacturers are going to be bearing the brunt of this increase. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Can we round out on comments? BMW.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to also respond to the comments from the Honourable Member about social investment, which is something that I think is very critical in South Africa. I think the Honourable Member will appreciate that in our industry is very capital intensive, which means we need to put bricks and mortar on the ground in terms of where we operate. And I think we sit in a very fortunate position because in our industry we are, I would say, evenly spread across all provinces. We are in Gauteng, KZN, Eastern Cape, and we are really in those regions investing not just in what we do, but also in the communities that surround our operations. I think if also the committee as well can cast their eye on some of the statements that we are making in conjunction with the master plan that we've come up with government. Transformation is a big, I would say, lever in that master plan. And we as an industry, we are coming together to try and create what we call a transformation fund, which will be impacted with some of these amendments that I have seen being discussed today. But we are doing that to make sure that throughout the whole value chain, we actually can obviously transform our value chain as well as also take some of the operations to the geographical areas that we did not have anything in the past. So we are working on a strategy like that. So all I'm trying to say, honorable members and committee, that you, whatever you say doesn't fall on deaf ears, but it takes time. And we also appreciate the support that we are getting in setting up these schemes that is going to try and make sure that we transform our value chain. Thank you, Chair.
Can we close on comments? Because now you are making closing comments, all of you. And I see more hands. Once I allow all of you, why do I have not to allow others? Let's reach a stage where we say it's enough for today. What I should acknowledge is that public participation is the cornerstone of the legislative process. And this is not the first and it's not the last engagement. And Treasury and SARS are still open to bilaterals and multilateral discussions on a whole range of issues that we have raised. And issues that have been raised here, we'll make sure that we make follow-up. Because this is not an academic exercise. We are not at the university here. We are in Parliament. So you should not think that when you come here, raise issues, we don't make follow-up. Because in Parliament, we take decisions. And decisions have to be followed up. So all the issues that you have raised, we'll make sure that together with the Treasury and SARS, we find a way of handling them. Let's all of us find a solution which is in the best interest of the country. It's not the intention of government to overburden compliant taxpayers. Because South Africa is not the only investment destination. Companies have got options to go and invest somewhere else. And if our taxes are over the roof, they are so high to such that investors can't cope, they will vote by leaving the country to go and invest somewhere else. So we are not doing things in such a manner that we are not aware of the situation that you find yourself in as compliant taxpayers. So we'll never make decisions that are detrimental to the taxpayers. But we are also making a call to taxpayers that they should respect the laws of the Republic and be loyal to the laws of the Republic. So that's what I've been Honorable Karim has been emphasizing since we started, because he has been working with you for quite a number of years. As much as we are two houses, NA and NCOP, at the end we are parliament. We work together as colleagues, and there has to be continuity, because they have been doing good work when he and his colleagues were running this committee on standing committee on finance. You pick up a battle which you won't finish now, right at the end. So we'll make follow-up on a whole range of issues. I know there are many stakeholders which have made, would have liked to meet us as an individual company. It's just that if you remember, the parliamentary session started late this year because of the elections in May. So hence our schedule is very, very, very tight. And not so long, Parliament will be rising. So between end May and before we rise, we should have completed all the parliamentary business. Hence you see sometimes we run business together with NCOP. The past 2 weeks, we have been going around meeting treasury entities together. And we have been doing well, cooperating and collaborating. So feel at ease that we're not inviting you here to just to listen to you, and from here we'll take decisions that are not in your best interest. No, we regard your inputs very, very serious. Thanks very much, Honorable Karim, our colleague and colleagues from NCOP, and members of the Standing Committee. From here, we'll take the process up with SARS and Treasury and make submissions to Parliament. And then from there, we'll continue to engage on other business. And as I've said, even make follow-up on the issues that have been raised here. Thanks, officials from Treasury and also SARS. You have been helpful in responding to issues. The meeting is adjourned.